2018 was the beginning. From podcast to live events, Fight Night Picks was off and running.
Do you typically train for a fight with a specific game plan in mind, or do you train for a certain opponent?
Promise to God, I always have the same game plan.
A year later, a new ad.
The cringe fest continues with Henry Cejudo. He pulled out a snake today. Old clip.
Since then, it's been a wild ride. 2022 shaping up to be another crazy year.
Hurt Chandler. He might be peacocking right now. I think that left hook hurt.
Oh, peacock right here. It's Michael Chandler.
Oh, they've both been hurt this
time. Oh!
So as they say, let's get into it.
And welcome back to another episode with Fight Night Picks, getting set for UFC Vegas 48 coming at you from the Apex. They had to pay for that $100 million facility with some fight, some way, somehow. And they're up in the ante this weekend. We have the loss of Rafael Dos Anjos taking on Fazeev. Now, with that fight moved over to the UFC 272 card, that's in a few weeks. We do have Jamahal Hill taking on Johnny Walker in the main event. And listen, that fight was announced on Friday. This is backing up. Friday, 8 days before the fight's actually supposed to take place. That was originally scheduled for 3 rounds. Now it's 5. So it will be interesting to see what we get coming up this weekend. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. Sponsorship opportunities, you can hit me up. You can find Matt at Matt Allen FNP. So listen, I expect this week to be a week for the hardcores. You have a total of 12 fights, I assume. I really do assume that Mario Bautista will find a short notice opponent, Khalid Taha, out of their fight. We will update that one as is necessary.
I thought that was going to be a good fight, honestly. I know I'm going to sound like a weird MMA hipster there, but I thought that was genuinely going to be an exciting fight this weekend.
I do too. And I mean, I think we're going to get some decent one. This is going to be one of those cards. It's really going to be buy low, sell high. Hopefully you get to sell high because we're buying low at the start of the week. Only 2 ranked fighters on this card. They're in the main event. If you go to next week, you have Benil Dariush taking on Islam Makhachev. Those are 2 of 3 ranked fighters on that card. Armin Tsarukyan, the only other ranked fighter. So you have plenty of ranked fighters in the UFC. We only get 5 of them. So this is an opportunity to shine for some of these prospects coming up this weekend.
And for sure. Now, there's no knock against this main event because, listen, it's not their fault that they were upped into this position. It is going to be interesting to see if those extra 2 rounds do play a part because, of course, Johnny Walker does have 5-round experience in the UFC, that being his last fight, whereas Jamahal Hill, still very young in his UFC career. That's the thing I always have to remind myself about Hill. Very young, and his fights end very fast. This is going to be a very big opportunity for him, and I'm sure we're going to learn a lot about Jamahal Hill in this weekend's main event. But like you said, this card is going to be, this is like a prospect watch card. Maybe not every fight is going to be, you know, Adesanya versus Whitaker at the technique level, but it should entertain, and that's really the goal of this sport.
Champions Creed MMA's own Chad Anheliger. He's 35 years old, the Canadian, making his UFC debut. He's going to be taking on Jesse Strader. You also have UFC debuts out of Nova Uniao's Nicholas Mata. You talk about an anticipated debut. This guy's been matched up 3 different times. He finally gets that curse fight against Jim Miller. They obviously had that one scratched last year. The other debut that you have is Rufus Sports Christian Rodriguez. This is a guy that you have to watch. Now, let's throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen with Fight Night Picks, and we'll give you an idea of the 2 bangers that we're looking at coming up this weekend.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
So coming up this weekend, Gabriel Mugley Benitez is going to be taking on David Onama. And if you learned anything about Uganda's David Onama in his last fight, it's that he's down to bang on a few days' notice, up a weight class against an uber hype prospect in Mason Jones, losing that fight unanimous decision 29-28. But man, he definitely showed not just heart, but a complete skill set that you knew that he already had coming into the UFC. But I was really impressed with David Onama. I mean, I had a lot of good things to say. You can go back and watch that prediction video if you want to get an overall sense of the giddiness that I had for David Onama coming into the UFC. But Gabriel Benitez, I mean, you talk about a guy that can kick and kick and kick. If you like Charles Jourdain, you like Gabriel Benitez. And this fight should deliver fireworks because they're striking, man. It's second to none at 145. It's really fun to watch.
I don't care about Gabriel Benitez's record anymore because entertainment value, he always delivers. It's kind of like Douglas Silva de Andrade that we saw last night. No matter what the result of the fight is, it's going to be a really good fight, and that's all that matters. With David Onama, like you said, he proved that he comes to throw down in his last matchup against a guy like Mason Jones, who we all understand is a very, very skilled fighter, especially up at 155 pounds. So this is going to be a really, really interesting fight because let's say Onama does fight Benitez like he fought Mason Jones, then it might give Benitez at least a little window of opportunity to come into this fight. I think it's going to be a great fight no matter what, though.
Should be a great fight. And if we switch it on over to our second choice, this is one that's out of left field. And let me explain why. Because for Chad and Helliger, making his UFC debut, his last time out, a decision win. And Dana White said after that, you know, the guy was a 5-1 underdog. And he's Canadian, so yeah, I'm not joking. That's what Dana White said, and then they were like, come on over, Chad, we'll sign you. It was the weirdest thing ever, but if you've watched Chad and Helliger fight in the past, the guy boxes and boxes and boxes your head in. He comes out of Champions Creed MMA, Hakeem Dawodu's gym, and he is down to throw down. And if you look at it for Jesse Strader, this guy's boxing and his combinations to the body mixed in with his leg kicks, they're very, very fun to watch. And listen, he had a UFC debut on very, very short notice against Montel Jackson, got dropped twice in that fight.
That was bad.
By about the same strike, but when it comes to a fight like this, I think this is going to be a great one. You got Jesse Strader in his natural weight class, looks bodied up on Instagram. And for Chad and Helliger, a guy who's spent time at 125 in the past, he was a former Rise FC champ there. Former Rise FC Bantamweight champ knocked out Brady Hystan, Ultimate Fighter finalist in the last season. So that's why I think this fight, both guys struggle on the ground, but both guys capitalize and accentuate their skill level when it comes to the striking.
It should be a really fun fight. I can see this being a world where this is a fun fight, but not a great fight technique-wise, because both guys could get tired punching themselves out because they are so offensively oriented. But that's why this is in the fight of the night screen, is because anything could happen, especially on the feet in this matchup. It should be a great opportunity. Like you said, there's not that many Canadians right now that we can shine a spotlight on in the UFC, so hopefully Chad can do us proud in the great white north.
Chad and Helliger taking on the man himself, Jesse Strader, Aaron Carter, former boxing coach. Some big time fights coming up this weekend. If you want to see yourself, your brand, on the fight of the night screen, well, we are accepting those applications. Hit us up on the emails or the Instagram DMs, and we'll continue on with the big card that is, or at least the card that is, UFC Vegas 48. So listen, I'll be straight up with the Fight Night Picks fans. There was a shoey that happened on the Fight Night Picks companion last weekend, UFC 271. Derek Lewis tied to Ivasa. What a wild fight that was. Matt got off to a very early lead with Fight Night Picks. I was down, what, 8 or 9 picks on the first two cards?
It was two cards.
I've just been clawing myself back. But Matt's still in the lead as he looks to end the reign. And listen, Matt, it's been a really interesting year, too. I mean, with some of the Fight Night cards, the talent level maybe hasn't been up to snuff with the last few years. But when it comes to the excitement level out of some of these fights and the opportunity to make some of these picks, it has been a lot of fun kind of coming into this year. Man, we've been treated to some very good pay-per-views as well.
We have been, but this is a rough Fight Night card, if we're all being honest. Like, it is unfortunate that the main event fighters are sort of thrust into a spotlight that they weren't even asking for, if I can say it correctly. And I do think it will be a good fight, though. Like, Johnny Walker's proven that, hey, he is sort of a top-level, at least entertainer. I think we can all agree to that much. He does add a little bit of oomph to it. With Jamal Hill being a rising contender, I think it should be a great fight. And, like, Joaquin Buckley, viral star, of course, that's going to draw a lot of eyeballs. And I think that's going to be a really fun fight, too, that not a lot of people are talking about. There's Joaquin Buckley, sort of the head kick knockout artist, who is also susceptible to getting knocked out. And Abdul Razak Al-Hassan, who was cut from that exact same cloth. Sometimes he goes in there, scores a beautiful knockout. Sometimes he fights Chaos Williams and gets brutally knocked out. That's just how the game goes, but that should be a phenomenal fight.
Oh, I've got a lot of fun planned for this card, because where the fights are where they are, and there's a lot of unranked fighters, you know, the majority of them, we're going to have a ball coming up this week. So you're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.
While we might not be as hot on the nickname as some others, we have JSP, Jonathan Pierce, coming up against a short-notice replacement this weekend in C-Rod, Christian Rodriguez, a guy who grew up in the gym of Rufus Sport, and it was a lot of fun going back, really watching the tape on Rodriguez. I mean, he had an extensive amateur career, makes his pro debut against another pro debut over with Bellator. That was on the Chandler Pitbull card with Bellator, so crazy to see
high profile.
For Christian Rodriguez, opportunities with Bellator, CFFC, LFA, like he's really kind of been around the block and fought some decent levels of competition in his short MMA career. I mean, he's 7-0 already. He's only 24 years old, so he really does have a high ceiling. And I'm going to talk a lot about the technique of Christian Rodriguez, especially in a fight like this. But we talk about some of the prospects on this card not being as deep, not necessarily with the name value recognition, and I'll talk about JSP as well, but Matt, for Christian Rodriguez, I got really excited when I went back and watched some of his fight tape. So I have this whole rule that I have where when I hear superstars in the NBA talk about sort of up-and-coming guys glowingly, that's when I get excited about those up-and-coming guys. Like, when you hear Kevin Durant talk about how good Scottie Barnes and Evan Mobley are, you can get excited about those young players as a fan because you're like, wow, that guy really knows what he's talking about. Christian Rodriguez has everybody at Rufus Sport vouching for him and very well-respected members at that gym doing it, and that's why I'm so excited for him making his debut. Yeah, we had one big scare last week where it was unfortunate for City Kickboxing. Carlos Ahlberg had a fight that happened against Fabio Stron.
Unforgettable one.
Israel Adesanya had a very competitive fight with Robert Whittaker, but the hyped-up prospect at the start of the card in Blood Diamond, he was hyped up by everybody. Adesanya really went out of his way to hype him up, and it just didn't happen. But for Rodriguez, much younger in his career, much more well-rounded.
And there's more people. Like, with Adesanya, that's his main training partner. The Pettis brothers like Rodriguez. Paul Felder does. Gerald Meerschaert. Like, he does have a lot of people who are sort of looking out for him in that regard. It's just nice to see for someone getting into the sport. Because, again, not to go off on some weird tangent, but in MMA, it's very rare that you have someone who's brought up by this one gym, who has a lot of good veterans looking out for them, who has a good foundation for skills, and who actually stays around. Christian Rodriguez does seem to check a lot of those boxes early on.
So if you look at it for Christian Rodriguez, he was on Dana White's Contender Series this past summer, and if you look at the fight that he had, it was an interesting one against Junior Cortez, and listen, in that one, 5-0 versus 5-1, it happened back in October, you had the man himself, Rodriguez, as a slight favorite. I guess he was in around a minus 195, but going into that fight, you had Rodriguez miss weight, which was very unfortunate. He ends up getting the win, and the weirdest part about the entire experience was the UFC decided to sign the Cage Warriors champion and Jake Hadley who missed weight. But then when it came to Rodriguez, Dana White was like, yeah, well, you were 5-0 and you missed weight. And there's going to be more opportunities. So when you get your opportunity, come out and fight. So what Rodriguez does, he goes back out there. He fights with North American Fighting Championship Super Brawl. Gets a verbal submission win over Ryan McIntosh, who was 19 and 36 at the time. And I went out and I thought, you know what? I really want to see this fight tape in NAFC. So I did my Google search, I looked on Facebook, and then I found one of the guys from Rufus Sports saying, no, they're not streaming this event. So there's no tape on this, nobody can see it. So I have no idea how that fight went. And honestly, it sounds Bush League for me. There's nobody that goes harder to find tape. I go so hard in the paint, deep in the weeds, whatever you want to say to find fight tape. I could not find that NAFC. So if you can find it, send me a link down below. But they didn't stream it. There's nothing out there. And that is all I have to say. But through the rest of the fights that I could find, again, CFFC, LFA, Bellator, out of Rodriguez and the technique, beautiful 1-2. And then off of the 1-2, he can really land whatever strike he wants into his leg kicks. The best thing, too, high school wrestling advantage that he has. And listen, is wrestling his biggest strength? Not necessarily, definitely not offensively, but defensively, he's really able to get out of some sticky situations in his fights.
I really do worry about him grappling, though, with a guy like JSP. And listen, I can openly admit, I wasn't the biggest Jonathan Pierce guy. He had one of the worst UFC debuts you can have. He got embarrassed by a sort of veteran who's been aging himself out of the sport. Because, let's be honest, like, Joe Lauzon isn't really looked at, especially at that stage of his career, the same way that we speak about a guy like Jim Miller, who fights this weekend. Like, with Jim Miller, he's definitely older in his career, but there's still some tread left on those tires. Whereas, with Lauzon, he's a little bit further past. He looked great against JSP, and that just made me really concerned about the future for Pierce, but he has completely recollected himself and really improved on that first performance. And it's not just that he's improved in small ways, it's that he got completely out-grappled in his UFC debut. So you're probably thinking to yourself, okay, you really have to question this guy's grappling defense moving forward. He's looked amazing ever since, and it hasn't just been like he goes out there and he out-athleticisms guys. No, he's someone who can chain his takedowns together, will use the clinch to then set up his takedown attempts. It's been a really nice progression out of Jonathan Pierce, because how many guys do we see come into the UFC? Fabio Chiron. And they're just sort of that same guy from their first fight into their second fight into their third fight. Jonathan Pierce at first looked like he could have been going down that road, but he's really shown great improvements ever since.
In that fight against Joe Lauzon too, the trouble was Lauzon was using these long-range weapons, hitting JSP, rocking them, and then all of a sudden that really set everything up for Lauzon. So I honestly wonder that one. It was the moment too much too soon.
It very well could have been.
You look at the next two fights for Jonathan Pierce. He goes out there and fights another well-rounded guy in Kai Kamaka. When you compare Kamaka to a guy like Rodriguez, Kamaka's much more wrestling intensive, and his combinations a little bit slower. Definitely not as much power, which is kind of funny to say because Rodriguez is a volume guy. But once that volume starts to add up, he can really, really hurt his opponents. But JSP against Kamaka, he's able to go out there, go 5 of 7 of takedown attempts, really grind him out, finish him on the mat, and that really impressed me. Then his next fight out against Omar Morales, the weird thing about Jonathan Pierce, and this is the funny thing about this fight, you're going to see it for Christian Rodriguez on the screen. Last time he weighed in, he takes that fight against Ryan McIntosh back in January. It was at a catch weight of 150 pounds. Rodriguez has fought all over the map in terms of his weigh-ins. He fought Junior Cortez at bantamweight, but he missed weight. Then before that, he has a bantamweight fight with CFFC. Then before that, a catch weight at 140 against John Pham, where he finished him. And it was really nice the way he was able to get it down to the mat. And it almost looked like, is he going to sink it from this angle? Oh yeah, he's got it. So it is weird to see where Rodriguez fits in, because when I look at him fight, I go, oh, this guy's a bantamweight. Frame-wise, height-wise, everything, this guy's a bantamweight. You look at JSP at 145, the guy's massive. And against Omar Morales, it was like, okay, Omar's massive. Omar's bigger in this fight, but Omar was a long-time lightweight, and I don't know why after 35 he decided to make the change to featherweight. But all that to say, at the start of that fight, in the first half of the first round, Omar Morales is having a lot of success. There was a point where Pierce goes for like a lazy takedown. He's kind of off balance on the break. He gets cracked by a right hand of Morales, and you think, oh, maybe this is the beginning of the end. But JSP goes out there, chains together his takedowns. In that fight, he goes 6 of 11, and he finishes Morales on the ground. And Morales' only ever other loss in the UFC, other than that, was Giga Chikadze. So kind of crazy to see that. But Matt, when I look at this fight, I really do consider it. I mean, we don't have odds because it was originally supposed to be Austin Lingo and Jonathan Pierce. A very interesting fight. Lingo's a big guy for 145. He always plots forward. He really backs you up against the cage, does good work. But when it does come to this fight, I do see Rodriguez having success with his hands in the first round. I just wonder how he's going to make out with the size of Jonathan Pierce coming out of fight ready in this one.
And that's the thing. Like, Omar Morales can use some of his physicality to sort of chuck Jonathan Pierce off of him. And even he couldn't really do that at a certain point. That's what I worry about with Rodriguez. Even if he does have success in the first round, he doesn't really have enough pop, I don't think, to hurt Pierce enough to finish him in that first round. And if it does go into the second or the third, I think it does sort of start to shift towards Jonathan Pierce because of his overall grappling game. And that's the thing. If Pierce does get you down to the mat, he is always working. He's trying to get into half guard. He's trying to get into full mount. He's threatening with a lot of different things, which is going to force you to be active off of your back and force you to waste a lot of energy. So I do like Jonathan Pierce in this matchup. And this is the last thing that has to be said. Even if, like, on full training camps, yes, Christian Rodriguez might have a good chance. It's on a week's notice. That's a really hard ask for anyone to do, to come in on 1 week's notice and fight someone like Jonathan Pierce. That's all.
I would have loved to have seen a full camp, because Rodriguez does a great job cutting the cage for a young guy. The way that he moves on the feet and his takedown defense up against the cage is very, very good. Pierce is just so much bigger. And you talk about wrestling. I mean, he was a high school state finalist at Science Hill. So that's funny.
But I think it's fair to say Jonathan Pierce is a much more wrestling-heavy MMA fighter.
And Jonathan Pierce, when he wrestled in high school, 125 and 133 pounds. How crazy is that? Must have taken a big growth spurt there near the end. But yeah, I mean, in this fight, it's a tricky one. I love Rodriguez's ceiling. I want to see him compete at 135 moving forward. But we get this opportunity here on short notice, and sometimes it works out. David Onyema, Mason Jones, and he's coming up this weekend against Mowgli Benitez. But in this fight, both of us right now going with Jonathan Pierce. Can't wait to see these guys face off on Friday. Sets us up well for Question Mark Kicks 2 hours before the prelims coming up this Saturday. And listen, I'm looking forward to the fights. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. They have a saying up in Canada that if you're coming on, come on. And it was originally from Niagara Falls with Howard Clarence Howard. But that was the 90s. This is now. And representing Consort Alberta by way of Airdrie, we have a guy who trains in Calgary in Chad the Monster and Helliger, and this guy is a lot of fun to watch. It's not often that you have a fighter making a UFC debut, having started their MMA career at 2-5, and then going on a 9-fight win streak, plenty of finishes along the way, 9 of the 11 by finish, 6 knockouts. And for Chad and Helliger, former Rise FC champ at 125, at 135, and he's really been able to recreate his MMA career by switching camps and going to Champions Creed MMA out of Calgary. Like I had mentioned, I mean, Hakeem Dawodu over there, he picked up a giant win his last time out against Mike Trezano a couple of weeks ago. And for Ann Helliger, it really was a lot of fun to watch him fight his last time out. He took on Muin Gafarov. And if you watch that fight against Gafarov, it was an interesting one. I mean, his opponent had a master of combat sambo background. He had fights against John Lineker, Reese McLaren, and Kevin Bellingon over with ONE Championship.
Which is wild that he was fighting on Contender Series.
That really was it. And I mean, he was putting on for Tajikistan. We hadn't had any fighters in that region in the UFC. He was a giant favorite. And Ann Helliger goes out there, drops him fairly early, second round, opponent comes back, wins the round, third round, relatively close, but Ann Helliger gets the win, ends up getting the win by split decision, and Dana White's reasoning after the fight was, 5-1 underdog, and he's Canadian, so what the hell? Don't like that when the boss signs a guy for a what the hell, because he's Canadian, but for Ann Helliger, a very, very fun style. I don't know what the ceiling's going to be where he just had his 35th birthday a couple of months ago, but it's an opportunity to win this weekend taking on Jesse Strader.
And that's the thing for Ann Helliger. He's going to have a fan-friendly style. He's going to be sort of one of those, it might be too early to say this, but maybe even a Joe Rogan's favorite if he catches him on the right prelim. Because remember the last sort of big Canadian prospect that was hyped up who was in his 30s, who had a really good UFC debut, and then never really fully attained all of his hype? Am I almost perfectly describing Gavin Tucker?
From Atlanta, Canada?
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's a lot of parallels between these two guys because there were some concerning signs about Gavin Tucker coming onto the UFC scene. He didn't fight a very high level of competition on the regional scene. There was one of those stats where if you combine the records of all of his opponents, it was like 30-90. Like, it was not very good at all. But if you just looked at the positives, you could look at, wow, he's got such great volume striking. He's got wrestling, too. I feel like with Ann Helliger, there could be a version of that out there that I am a little bit concerned about because you look at his striking, and it is really flashy, it is very exciting, but he does get into some 50-50 exchanges, which are always going to make a fight much closer than they have to be. But again, when you're 35 years old coming into the UFC, is that the worst thing for him? Like, I kind of look at this fight two different ways. Like, breaking it down X's and O's wise, I still think Ann Helliger is probably the slightly more skilled guy in this, and we'll get to Strader in a minute. But for him and sort of his overall career trajectory, it's either are you going to fight your way all the way to a title shot, or do you just want to be like the fun Scott Holtzman kind of veteran guy, make your mark while you're here and get out? Because I think he could have that kind of a streak to him if he wanted to. He doesn't have the best record coming in. He is only 11-5. He is 35 years old. Like, there are some concerning signs. But I can't sit here and say I dislike anything about his MMA game, especially watching it. It is so much fun.
Yeah, there's one major thing that I don't like. It is the grappling. Now, for Ann Helliger, giant positive. When you're taking on a master of combat sambo, you're in the third round. Your coach says, listen, you got to defend all the takedowns. He defended every single takedown in the third round of that fight. If I'm not mistaken, there were 7 takedown attempts. Pieced him up on the feet. Taking on a really good fighter. Again, you're kind of brought in with, you know, the Billy Talent, nothing to lose when no one knows your name.
One of those classic Lambda Slaughter Contender Series fights. Like, there's one of those every single time around where it's like, wait, why is there a -700 as the co-main event?
And the worst part about it was, for Ann Helliger, you had the selling point of, well, he beat Brady Hystan over with Rise to keep that bantamweight strap, and that is great. And then there was a long layoff, almost 2 years between that fight and the fight against Gafurov. So it is interesting. I mean, for Ann Helliger, again, those losses were so long ago, all 5 of them by submission. Jesse Strader will not submit Chad Ann Helliger. If it happens, I'll do another shoey on the internet. But for Jesse Strader, very much cut from the same cloth. He is a car crash striker. And the best part about Jesse Strader, decent cardio, even though he does tend to finish his fights early. You look at him over on Instagram, I think he's probably the most bodied up fighter on this card. The strength and conditioning is absolutely insane. He's been working his boxing with a boxing coach.
You don't think Chaz Skelly has that honor?
No, I don't. And for Jesse Strader, The best part about his game and the way that he can win out in a fight like this, he's definitely the bigger fighter. He's definitely the longer fighter. He uses leg kicks to great effect, and he starts at the body and works his way up to the head, something that you rarely see in MMA, and his combinations are so fast and so crisp, and a little bit of power on the end. I mean, listen, the loss to Montel Jackson, you hate to see it, but if Montel Jackson fought every other weekend, he could be a superstar. And then the other part about it, his other loss was to Marcelo Rojo a few years ago over with Combate. And if you want to get specific about it, that fight was 3 years and 2 months ago. So it's been a while. But Jesse Strader coming into the UFC, I was a little bit down on him. You definitely didn't learn anything out of that Jackson fight. You did learn, again, hand speed. Good job working the body even in that fight. But when it went bad, it did go really bad. But I hold Montel Jackson in very high regard.
I think Montel Jackson will be in the top 15 sooner rather than later. I really do. Like, that's how good of a... Like, his stand-up, 9 out of 10, and that might not even be doing it service. He has great submission ability, amazing submission defense, a great grappler. Like, he checks all those boxes. This is an interesting fight, because the way I look at it is, and Helliger's probably the steadier fighter. I agree with you, Strader has good cardio, but he almost fights in those big bursts, kind of similar to Jared Cannonier over the weekend, where Cannonier won't do anything for like 1-2 minutes at a time, and then he'll burst with a big action. I can see this fight being very similar to that, where if Strader does have success, it'll be one of those big bursts. And I like exactly what you said, this is my big point I wanted to bring up too, Strader is good at setting up his power shots. He will go to the legs and then try to use those techniques to then open up your head. And against a guy like Ian Helliger, it's going to be interesting if those work, because Chad does pressure forward a lot, and if you're trying to kick someone who's always pressuring you, you might be crowding your own distance, and you might be making it easier for him to hit you. And that's sort of where I land on this fight. Like, I know what the odds are on this, I know you want to get to those, but I think Ian Helliger has a great chance to win this fight, but I see this as being very 50-50, because I think we're going to get a lot of 50-50 exchanges where Ian Helliger might have to eat two shots to get on the inside. I think he will be able to land his two or three, because he is very dedicated to that game plan. Again, you don't go 11-5 and not make wholesale changes throughout your MMA game unless you are dedicated to, like, moving forward, trying to knock guys out. I think Ian Helliger is the steadier fighter, I guess, and that's what I keep on going back to. So I will predict him, but I think this is going to be a great showcase fight for both guys.
Well, I mean, at 135, Brian Keller has a tattoo of a skull with headphones on it. If you look at it for Chad Ian Helliger, he has a tattoo of a skull with crossbones, sunglasses, and flames. So I don't know who has the better tattoo, but for Chad Ian Helliger, it's pretty cool that way. And when I look at this fight, you talk about the odds, and you talk about the overall career trajectory of Ian Helliger. Like, could he be like a Murat Belaev over with ACB, where he has his pro debut a couple weeks shy of his 38th birthday, and now we're 46, we're still fighting, we're a former featherweight champ over there? It could happen.
I watch a lot of ACB, Craig.
I just have it, well, it's not even ACB anymore, but I do have a hard time trying to project that on him. So for Ian Helliger, opens minus 300 favorite, minus 279 right now.
Steep.
For Jesse Strader, open plus 250, is plus 222. At a minus 279, that's a 73.6% implied probability that Ian Helliger gets the win. And I don't see it that way, so that's why I have to go with the underdog. I like Jesse Strader with his pressure. I like him with his volume. I don't like his chin. But in a fight with Ian Helliger, I mean, I do think Strader has a good opportunity to win, more so than that implied probability. So I go with him. And Matt, I'll flip it on over to you this way. Ian Helliger, we talk about Canadians in MMA right now. I mean, Felicia Spencer retired, but his teammate Dawodu had a really good showing a couple weeks ago. In terms of Canadian MMA and a Canadian story that I have to pass along to everybody today, I went to Canadian Tire today. I had to get some oil. I also picked up for the first time in my life the most ratchet drink ever, Full Throttle Energy. Not as bad as I thought it would be. I definitely never thought I would drink one, but I was at Canadian Tire. Your options were limited. I'm walking around that store with a big baller brand hoodie, which sets off a weird energy. And then all of a sudden, one of Canada's biggest stars comes on the loudspeakers, as loud as I think they could have played it. And they played Nice for What by Drake, the clean version. And I felt like the weirdest person in that store that only was the only one who caught that vibe. So that is what I have to say. That's my Canadian story for the day. What? But I can't pick the Canadian in this fight.
That was a lot to break down. I like Chad in this matchup. Again, if he gets knocked out, I won't be surprised whatsoever, because his style plays more into him getting TKO'd. I know a lot of his losses do come by submission, but I think you'd agree with this. When he moves forward, it is with reckless abandon. And let's say he fought Montel Jackson. I have a very good feeling it would end in a very similar way that Jesse Strader's fight with Jackson did, but I will pick Ian Helliger in this matchup.
Both of us split on the pick. I'm going with California's own former Aaron Carter boxing coach, Jesse Strader. Listen, he's got an interesting nickname and an interesting fighting style, Matt, going with Alberta's own Chad.
He couldn't even get Aaron Carter ready to fight Lamar Odom, though. Is he that good?
Well, I mean, you look at where Aaron Carter gained weight for that fight. It was right front and center.
I guess Lamar is still a world-class athlete.
Big-time fight coming up this week. You let us know down below in the comments section if this one went off the rails and who you have in this fight. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, Canada half represent. We have Stony Creek's own Diana Balbizia taking on Brazil's Gloria De Paula. And for both of these fighters, it's been a rocky road in the UFC, straight 100%. Up. I mean, for De Paula, there was a lot of hype coming in off Dana White's Contender Series. She was a decent favorite in around a minus 260 when she took on Pauline Machias. And if you go back and watch that fight, her opponent, very, very credentialed wrestler. And Gloria is able to work with some of those takedown attempts and really piece her up on the feet. It was a great performance. Comes into the UFC, takes on Jinyu Frye. Probably thought Jinyu Frye lost a bit of a step. Nope.
Not even like, fighter who belongs in the weight class.
So. Yeah, no, she's an atom weight, but she was really able to go out there, impose her game plan. And then for Gloria to go out her last fight, take on Cheyenne Vlismas, you figure, okay, Cheyenne has the Taekwondo background. She can wrestle a little bit. Yeah, who knew that she'd turn all that into one in the first round and finish Gloria De Paula? Didn't think that was going to happen. For Diana Balbizia, it's been a weird run because she had experience against, you know, UFC level talent outside of the UFC, fought for KSW Flyweight Championship against the Queen of Violence and wasn't on the winning end of that one. So she goes out, she rebuilds herself, takes on a very poor level of competition.
Extremely.
The win that she had before coming into the UFC was over a 1-2 fighter, so you hate to see it. Lose to Molly McCann as a giant, giant underdog at 125 pounds. Lose to Liana Jojua, gets clinched up and then down on the mat, submitted. And then her last time out, she takes on Hannah Goldie in a fight where I wrote Diana Balbizia off. I thought she was going to be pretty bad in a matchup like that against Goldie, who really plays the volume game. And I had reservations about Balbizia making the move to 115. Diana drops Hannah in the first round. And then after that, it's fairly competitive. It really is. I mean, I thought Hannah Goldie won the third round of that fight going back and watching it. All three judges scored at 30-27. But regardless, Diana Balbizia ends up getting her first UFC win. She's the only one of these two fighters that has a UFC win. And I would hazard a guess that a loss for either of these two, you're probably done. Even with that win, you're probably done. So we're going to see what we get for Balbizia out of Romania. So I wonder what Sebastian Stan thinks of her performances. But really, when it comes down to this one of the weirdest moves of camps, like to end up from Romania to Stony Creek, Ontario, and then also training out of Muskoka Martial Arts. Like, we're in cottage country with Kyle Nelson.
I was gonna say, that'd be like, it's just a very big vibe switch, you'd imagine. But hey, she seems to enjoy it. Ontario, very nice, the times I've been.
318,000 Instagram followers as well. My last point for Diana Balbizia. But her last time out against Goldie, great knockdown in the first round. But what are you kind of thinking about her skill set?
You're not going to like this, and I don't even like saying this, but hear me out. The best version of her game is kind of like Hanata Moicano. Like, the best version. I'm not here to tell you she can submit people like he can, but he's a very upright striker, relies on a lot of 1-2s and long-range attacks. If things go to the mat, I do worry about her quite a bit, but she's in a really interesting group because technically, I don't think her jiu-jitsu is awful by any means, but she doesn't seem to be very physically strong in any weight class that she's been in. But I do think that that's an important part with this fight being down to strawweight, because at flyweight, especially against Jojua, who's a big flyweight too, she really did get out-muscled in that matchup. And that's why there is a part of me that thinks, okay, we sort of have to throw out Balbizia's first two performances in the UFC. And we have to sort of reset our palate to what she looks like at strawweight, because it was an improved version. And I know beating Hannah Goldie doesn't really prove to anybody that, wow, you're a top 15, a top 25, much less top 15 fighter. But still, when you need a win and you go out there and you can stop that two-fight losing streak from becoming a three-fight losing streak, that's always a positive. But like you said, both these athletes desperately need a win this weekend, because for Gloria De Paula, there were a lot of promising skills coming into the UFC. You saw what her ground game was like. You saw the aggression in her strikes and her capability of putting power and volume strikes together. And then we haven't seen that fighter whatsoever in the UFC. And it's been really interesting because against Cheyenne Vlismas, I thought she had a great opportunity to win that fight. Like, when you break down both fighters and what their skills are, like, Gloria De Paula, for no reason, should be getting TKO'd a minute into that matchup, but she just makes a lot of mistakes throughout her fights, and especially at the UFC level. So for me, I worry about both fighters, if I'm being completely honest, and what their ceilings are in the UFC. And I guess the last point that I'll give is, you have a 5-4 fighter taking on a 4-16 fighter. And when you 14 and 6, goodness, I struggle with that. My issue with Belbeats' record, though, that you had sort of touched on looking at her top five, is that a lot of her wins are over extremely low levels of competition. And I don't just mean fighters who are like, you know, maybe 4-3. It's like 0-1, 0-0, 1-1 type fighters. And that always concerns me for any fighter who's at the UFC level, but they've sort of built their resume off of those types of fighters.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting. If you look at it for Belbeatsia, a former national kickboxing champ over with Romania, and for Gloria De Paula, a very, very good Muay Thai background. So you expect these two to strike. For Belbeatsia, where the strength aspect comes into play, because I do agree with it. At 115, much bigger fighter than Hannah Goldie. Now, Hannah Goldie is a big fighter for that division, but Belbeatsia drops her, ends up really trying to kind of figure it out, don't want to let Goldie really kind of knock loose those cobwebs that she's feeling, so she really puts the pressure on. She's just hammering away long range trying to get the finish. Goes up close to the cage with Goldie with her back to the cage, tries to land a right cross, and Goldie just goes like this and pushes her just a little bit. I'm not joking. And Belbeatsia falls completely down, and then she's in guard. Like, it's bad. Now, Belbeatsia was able to get back up to her feet after that. The round continues on, but that really does scare me. Not necessarily in this fight, but especially moving on. Like, there's another thing that she does where she throws 1-2, but she throws at a decent volume, but not at a good percentage. And that's another thing that really does scare me. Definitely a negative striker so far in the UFC. The one other thing she does, and you'll see it if you play the UFC video game, so there might be a little bit of parallels. If you stand at distance, or if you're just moving forward and just tap circle on a PlayStation, you throw a naked leg kick that just kind of touches the calf. It does no damage in the video game. Diana Belbeatsia throws a ton of those leg kicks where you drop your hands just a little bit, you pop that leg kick out there just for a different look, but she does it a lot. It worries me. Again, in this fight, moving forward, it worries me quite a bit. So, interested to see this matchup. For Belbeatsia, open to minus 260 favorite. She's minus 115 right now. Big mover and shaker is Gloria De Paula, who opened a plus 220. She's a minus 106. We have a look at the Tapology votes for this fight. Surprised us there to you. Belbeatsia opened as a decent favorite. The odds are almost at par. I expect them to flip-flop or switch polls, I guess, as the week goes on. So I'm going to say, though, over under 70% the fans going with Belbeatsia.
I hope it's 50-50.
Nope. Oh, boy. 526 total votes, 91% Belbeatsia, 88% have her to win by decision. For the 9% that have De Paula, 78% by decision. So the odds are almost at par from minus 220 or minus 260 and plus 220 to now at par. But over 90% of the fans have Belbeatsia. You going with the fans on this one?
This is kind of like a used car that the UFC is trying to sell us right now, okay? Like, whoever wins this fight is going to get the used car treatment of, well, hey, they just came off a win over Gloria De Paula or Belbeatsia. Like, for me, I don't really care who wins this fight because I don't know what it does for that fighter's career. I shouldn't say I don't care about it. I just won't change my opinion on either fighter based on the result of this matchup. Because if Belbeatsia beats Gloria De Paula, will that erase any of our concerns about her not having the deepest or most qualified resume? I wouldn't say it does. And for Gloria De Paula, this would be the best win on her record. I think that's fair to say. And like you said, she does need a win very badly if she wants to stay around in the UFC. I'm going to pick Belbeatsia just because we did see an improved version of her down at strawweight. So I do think that there are the improvements in her game there to be made. And we haven't seen all that much from Gloria De Paula in the UFC up until this point. But I will say this, and you brought it up. What Hannah Goldie was able to do was she showed that you can still out-muscle Belbeatsia. If Gloria De Paula moves forward when Belbeatsia throws one of those naked leg kicks, she might not be able to capitalize on it with her striking with a big power shot, but she might be able to take her down off of that. And if she can get three takedowns, rinse and repeat, it's not going to make the fight exciting by any means, but it might be able to get her the win.
Belbeatsia is a tricky fighter. Gloria De Paula hasn't even earned a takedown since she's been with the UFC, so that is a very, very tough ask. But again, in terms of her striking, you have a positive striker in Gloria De Paula, even in the losses. You have a slight positive Diana Belbeatsia. 6.72 strikes landed per minute to 6.33 absorbed. That is insane. Decent takedown defense. Obviously, Liana Jojua, once Belbeatsia got it to the mat, was able to submit her. But we'll see what happens coming up this weekend. In terms of my pick, I have Belbizia ever so slightly, just based on that long frame, able to hold the range. But if I know anything about Glory De Paola, she's able to crash distance very well. Obviously, the odds going like that throughout the week, it definitely does scare you away from a pick like that. So again, this is one, it's a fight that's going to happen. I'm going to go with the pop and popcorn and enjoy it. Both of us going with Romania and Canada's own Diana Belbizia out of the Stony Creek region. Muskoka Martial Arts own. You let us know down below who you have in the comments section in this fight at strawweight. And keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, somebody between these two is going to go 19-3 with one no contest. And one guy's going to drop an L. We have Mark Mugen-Striegel coming in, representing Philippines. He's going to be taking on Chaz Skelly. And for Chaz Skelly, he hasn't fought truly in the UFC since 2019?
Been a while.
He got a win over Jordan Griffin. He entered the cage to fight Jamal Emmers last year. And then Jamal had some issues backstage. Skelly gets to do a weird interview and get paid. And now we finally get to see him in a fight. And for Skelly, going back through watching the fights, watching that weird Bobby Moffitt fight that ends up his no contest on his record, because Bobby Moffitt had the choke. The referee stopped the fight, but Skelly protested. Then he protested for what? Like a couple of years? And then they overturned it to a no contest. Kind of crazy to see that one.
It's good that they finally fixed something, though. Like, how many times do we see something controversial happen and then nothing ever gets resolved?
So that one ends up in no contest. But the craziest part about Chaz Skelly's record, he's been in the UFC forever. Made his debut in 2014. Loses to Mirsad Bektic. Has wins over Tom Ninamaki, Sean Soriano, Jim Allers, Edmilson Souza, a loss to Darren Elkins, win over Maximo Blanco. That was a performance bonus because he was able to get an anaconda choke in 19 seconds. Beats Chris Gritsmacher, lost to Jason Knight. The no contest against Bobby Moffitt, the win over Jordan Griffin. There's only one fighter out of all those fighters I named that's still in the UFC. It's Chris Gritsmacher. So the longevity of Chaz Skelly.
Darren
is like,
Elkins is, isn't he?
He's like an old, and Darren Elkins. So there's two. But he's like an old junkyard dog. He's still here. He's got a positive record. He's coming out the other side. The weird thing for Chaz Skelly, though, you're 7-3 with no contest, and he has a 33% takedown defense rate and a negative 1.33 strike differential. You don't normally see that out of a guy who wins so many fights.
I think that takedown defense stat is quite misleading, though, because Chaz Skelly is such a talented grappler himself. He doesn't really mind getting taken down by people. Like,
that's where I'm going.
Well, okay, I don't know why I handed it off to me. Here's the thing about Chaz Skelly. He has a very developed submission game, and he can do it in a variety of ways. This isn't someone who only goes to the back and tries to finish with a rear naked choke. He gets it done with a lot of head and arm chokes. They're sort of defensive wrestling submissions that we don't see them very often. It's very Matt Hughes-esque. But the thing about Skelly is, he's cut from the same cloth as fighters like Gerald Meerschaert, Paul Craig, those types of guys who, they might eat more shots than you'd like on the feet. They have, I don't want to say great stand-up, I'd call it effective stand-up. It gets the job done and helps them close the distance and get in on the hips of their opponents. But that's always what I'm concerned about when I watch a Chaz Skelly fight. It's, can he get the fight to the ground before he eats so much damage that he can't really come back in the fight? Because the Jason Knight fight, I think, is a good example of what happens when everything goes wrong for Chaz Skelly. Jason Knight, I know he didn't have the best run in the UFC, but there was a short little time period there where he was a really dangerous fighter. Look back at his fight against Ricardo Lamas. Like, that was supposed to be Jason Knight's big coming-out show. For Knight, though, he was able to sort of out-grapple Chaz Skelly and just be really unorthodox on the mat. And through those exchanges, he was able to get on top and land a lot of really good ground and pound. Luckily for Chaz Skelly, Mark Striegel isn't necessarily that type of a fighter. But anytime Chaz Skelly's in there, that's really what the breakdown for me seems to be. It's how can he get the fight to the mat and how can he use his physicality? Because for Skelly, he's not in the Jake Shields camp. He's not in the Brian Ortega camp. He's an intelligent grappler, but he does go for a lot of submissions, which can sometimes let his opponent get back up to their feet. But I do really like the overall submission game from Skelly. It is very complete, and it's relentless, really. Like, when he does try to go for a submission, it is very unique the way that he can chain different things together, and that's what sets him aside from just your average 36-year-old in this division.
And this is a fight that I'm really looking forward to coming up this weekend, because Mark Striegel, I disagree a little bit. I mean, this guy is a Sambo guy. I mean, champion in Southeast Asia, and he's really put things together. I mean, 14 of his 18 wins coming by submission, and he's a guy that powers himself into takedowns. Like, I've seen really unorthodox ones where He goes for a low single leg, and then he just puts his hand around the guy's waist and just kind of pushes him over, dumps on top, gets into top position, and then he's really able to have his way in some of these fights. He's taken on a decent level of competition, as much as you could really ask for, but it's always weird when the UFC decides to sign a guy off of, you know, a no contest. I mean, he had the fight against Shunichi Shimizu, UFC veteran. He has a first round submission win against Kai Kara France on his record as well. But for Mark Striegel, it really is closing the distance, wearing guys down, taking them down, rinse and repeat. And the one thing about both of these guys do not have a very, you know, fun or fan-friendly type of style when it comes to what they do on the feet. They are not the best strikers. So for Mark Striegel, I'm interested to see what we get out of him, not just because, you know, I haven't seen him before, but because for this camp, it seems like he's been training out of the MMA lab. And I'm really eager to see what we get training with a guy like Kyler Phillips, guys like Benson Henderson, the guys that train at that gym, especially in the lower weight classes. You can add a little bit more in terms of the wrinkles that you can show in your game, especially against a guy like Skelly, where Striegel's going to take you down, Skelly's going to try and submit you. I mean, what else can we get out of that? I'm eager to see, again, the game plan that we get out of Striegel more than anything.
I think he is going to go for a lot of takedowns, but I do think that's going to be to his own detriment, because the way I look at this fight is Striegel is a very talented grappler, don't get me wrong, but he relies on a lot of explosion for his grappling advancements, whereas Skelly is the much more consistent fighter out of these two. He's the one who will just plot forward for 15 minutes, and it is to his own detriment. Like, he will eat power shots for 10 minutes just trying to get that takedown at the end of the second round, early third round, because that's how dedicated he is to the game plan. And that's why I do like Skelly in this matchup, because if he can be consistent and if he can at least be the one who initiates a lot of the grappling exchanges, I do think it's going to pay off for him, because we talk a lot about things like, you know, those water in the basement techniques, the leg kicks, the body shots, the things that add up over time. Skelly, since he isn't a talented striker, can't really rely on those techniques. But what he can do is be the first guy to initiate every grappling exchange, because I do think he has the superior cardio in this matchup. Again, and it speaks more to his output. Do I think Striegel has poor cardio? Not by any means, but he does do a lot of that explosion, a little bit of a reset period, and then explosion again. I think during those resets, that's when Skelly can have success. But the flip side of that could be, well, Striegel, every time he explodes, just gets the better of the position.
Well, I mean, the thing that scares me out of what you said, you know, if Skelly's going to get the win, he has to be the first one to initiate the grappling. Striegel's going to be the guy.
Not to initiate the grappling as in go for takedowns, but just be the one to get it into clinch range over and over. Because if you're the one deciding on when we're clinching, exactly like you said, Striegel's going to be going for those takedowns. You're almost playing into his game.
So the odds for this one, they haven't really changed all that much. Chaz Skelly open around a minus 220. He's still right there. Striegel open a plus 185, plus 178 on best fight odds. If we're sending over under, Matt, we're having a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say with Skelly, 67.5%. You're going to say over? Under.
I think they'll be lower just because of the inactivity.
So look at that. 535 total votes, 84% Skelly. You've got 56% by submission, 37% by decision. For the 16% that have Striegel, 52% by decision, 20% submission, 22% by knockout. I have Chaz Skelly in this fight, but there's certain fights on this card that I have a better read on than others. With Skelly, the inactivity, the fact that I've seen him dominated in certain grappling exchanges, the fights that he's lost, he's been out-grappled, not necessarily totally outstruck. He's had some issues in some of the grappling exchanges, which is his bread and butter. Striegel, I really like the bare bones of his game. He's like somebody else that's on this card, Stephanie Egger. She's got a great judo background. Mark Striegel has a great sambo background. It's just bringing all those pieces together. So I'm really eager to see this fight. It's one of my most anticipated of the weekend. I'm taking Skelly ever so slightly, though.
Yeah, I like Skelly in this matchup. I think it should be a fun grappling fight between these two guys. Just with Striegel, if he was a better striker and if he could explode his way into his takedowns using his striking a little bit more, I would favor him in this matchup. I just think he's going to have trouble later on the second and in the third round against a guy like Skelly, who is anything if not consistent with his approach, which is move forward, go for those takedown attempts, and just try to make this a grappling fight.
Look out for Striegel on his entries to leave his head wide open to the side for some of those defensive submissions of Skelly, but let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this fight. Both of us going with the man from Texas. We're both going with Chaz Skelly. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.
In a Fight Night Pick special, a couple of Matt's favorite names in the women's bantamweight division, we have Jessica Rose Clark taking on Switzerland's own Stephanie Egger, and a really interesting mix coming into this fight, because for Egger, a black belt in judo for the longest time, since the dawn of time, and listen, she's really rounded out her skill set. Now, obviously, striking, not her forte, but when it comes to her grappling, she definitely has a great jiu-jitsu base as well. She was a European champion in jiu-jitsu, then went to ADCC Worlds in 2019, losing to Gabby Garcia in overtime by points. How crazy is that? Can you picture that? It's hard to picture Stephanie Egger taking on Gabby Garcia.
Mackenzie Dern beat Gabby Garcia.
That's true, but still, it's absolutely wild stuff. So for Egger, she makes her UFC debut on incredibly short notice, takes on Tracy Cortez, and really gets beat at her own style. She gets held down for the majority of that fight. Cortez went 3 of 5 on takedown attempts, 9 minutes and 58 seconds of control time. So definitely of concern when you look at Egger and her future matchups. And her last time out against Shanna Young, well, she really just turned it back and looked like the fighter that beat King Reyna all those years ago. So a big win for Stephanie Egger, her last time out. That fight, not that long ago when we think about it, only about 4 months ago. For Jessica Rose Clark, she's one of the most interesting women in this division because she had so much success when she made her UFC debut. She beats Beck Rawlings, she beats Paige VanZant, and then all of a sudden, you're top of mind for a lot of MMA fans. She loses to Jessica Ai, she loses to Pani Kanzad, and then she has to rebuild things. And for Jessica Rose Clark, she's one of those fighters that's just not overly active. Now, recently, in the two-fight win streak she's on, she has been active, and it's been great to see. But she was one of those fighters you'd see once a year. It's almost like the Great Pumpkin. Is it going to come back? It does. And for Clark, she gets wins over Sarah Alper, looked amazing in that fight, a win over Jocelyn Edwards. And the craziest part about her last two fights is I thought Jessica Rose Clark was well-rounded. I thought her boxing was the best part of her skill set. And then in her last two fights, oh, so you're a wrestler now? It's been really, really nice to see that progression out of Clark, who now at 34 isn't necessarily the spry chicken in this division.
She isn't, but she has made a lot of really nice wholesale improvements to her game. And I think that's going to be the story of this matchup, because the fighter that Stephanie Egger is, I don't think has changed that much. I just think her level of competition has fluctuated quite a bit, because with Tracy Cortez, like, she's a borderline ranked fighter. At least that's the way people speak about her.
What division, though?
Well, that's the thing. But she is a very, very talented fighter. And then you look at who her next opponent was, Shayna Young. And I know I picked Young in that matchup, but let's be honest. I don't really think Young is in the caliber of fighter that someone like Jessica Rose Clark is. And that's why I think this is a really, really important fight for Egger, because this is a chance for her to sort of revamp her career. Maybe that's too strong of a word to use, but that loss against Tracy Cortez was a really bad one. She gets completely outgrappled. She does all right in the stand-up, but she is sort of stiff on the feet, and that always concerns me about her going out there and winning a 15-minute fight on the feet, because that's normally what I go down to when I try to break down a fighter striking. It's, okay, how long could they stay on the feet, be comfortable with it, and actually win rounds that way? When I look at Stephanie Egger's game, I don't really think, wow, that's a fighter who's going to go out there and really use her volume a lot to her benefit. But in this matchup against Jessica Rose Clark, it will be interesting to see how she is able to use her range in this fight. Because for Clark, she is a very pressure-heavy fighter. She always was with her boxing. And now that she has added in the wrestling component to her game, it helps her pressure even more. Because, like, we talk about Clay Guida probably too much on this channel, but Clay Guida is a guy who can use his boxing to pressure you back to the cage, or he can use his wrestling to pressure you back to the cage. Jessica Rose Clark is starting to fall into that line where she doesn't just need her big right hand or the jab to be able to get you moving backwards or up against the cage. Now she can employ her single leg, double leg wrestling, and it's been extremely effective in this last little two fight run.
Well, it scares me. If Clark decides to wrestle against Egger, I think she's going to lose this fight. I think that if she decides to strike, Egger's striking is very wonky, and it's the worst part about it. For somebody who's such a pure grappler, somebody who's so good at judo with those upper body throws to mix in with the jiu-jitsu, it is her bread and butter. But when Egger's at distance, it really is a lot of single shots, a lot of walking to crash that distance. You're going to struggle against a decent striker. And with the pressure of Clark, she can go in and out, dart in on angles. And I really do think that if she's going to win, that's going to be the way to it. Again, it does scare me when you decide to grapple with somebody that's as good as Stephanie Egger. And I get it. Tracy Cortez was able to use her wrestling.
But Cortez does fight in a very similar manner to Jessica Rose Clark. That is what I keep on going back to. Because Tracy Cortez, she uses her boxing to set up her wrestling. I understand Jessica Rose Clark might be sort of the opposite side of that. But it is a very similar game plan. That's why I do think Jessica Rose has got a lot of confidence coming into this matchup. Because she can fight in a similar manner to a fighter that gave Egger problems.
We have have a look at the odds for this one. Clark opened a minus 235 favorite. She's minus 197 right now for Stephanie Egger. Again, these are based off best fight odds. She opened a plus 200, plus 163. If we have a look at Tapology for the votes, and they are a surprise to us as they are to you, Matt, I'm going to set the over-under 85% Clark.
I think it'll be slightly under, but she'll be the favorite.
Ooh, look at that. 548 total votes, 86% Clark, 89% by decision for the 14% that have Egger, 68% by decision, 17% by knockout. I have Clark winning this fight by decision. Again, I think her striking is that much better than Egger's. And I, again, it would really scare me if she decides to kind of engage in some of that wrestling, engage in some of that grappling. I think all it's going to do is tire her out, and she's going to have issues in that that respect.
I think she has the better grappler. I think she has the better cardio in this matchup, though. Like, I really do. I think Jessica Rose Clark can win this fight no matter where she takes it, if I'm being completely honest. I think she has a big advantage on the feet, and I don't think Egger has the staying power on the mat. I think she has a good submission ability early on in the fight, but I do think that the fight will wear on her as it continues. Like, Jessica Rose Clark's game is, I'm going to break you down with my wrestling, I'm going to break you down with my pressure, and the second you start to get tired, that's really when I'm going to start to pour the pressure on. I don't know how Egger is going to keep the distance on the feet or on the mat. I just think it's a really tough matchup for Egger.
Hot take. Tony going with Jessica Rose Clark. We both are going with the fighter out of Australia. Let us know who you have down below in the comments section. Is it the Swiss fighter? We rarely ever say that in the UFC. In Stephanie Egger, are you going with Jessica Rose Clark? Can't wait for the card coming up this week, and especially the main event, Johnny Walker taking on Jamahal Hill. It should be a great one. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. My favorite fight coming up in the next 2 weeks, we have Gabriel Benitez taking on David Onama, the silent assassin. And for David Onama, made an incredibly short notice UFC debut up a weight class against a former Cage Warriors 2 division champion, Mason Jones. And Matt, I thought he did pretty darn good. I mean, he loses that fight. All three judges scored at 29-28. And maybe you could have made a case that Mason Jones won at 30-27. David Onama was in there for every single shot, landed power of his own, defended takedowns, really was able to implement his game. Yes, he lost. Short notice, up a weight class regardless. Onama coming into the UFC, it was one of those prospects, and I even went back. I thought, what did I have to say about him coming in? I said, win, lose, or draw in a fight against Mason Jones. I can't wait to see him in his original weight class of 145, and I'm still there. I'm still with it, even after that performance. It really did impress me, even in a loss, and to me, that's what you love to see. For Onama, undefeated as an amateur, 10-0. He was 8-0 coming into the UFC. And again, level of competition wasn't that bad for Onama. I mean, even you go back to it, his third to last fight coming into the UFC against Justin Overton, that was a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt in a fight that there wasn't a guaranteed lock that Onama was going to win it. It was back and forth. Onama, near the end of it, started to land his own takedowns, and he ends up getting Overton in a guillotine and finishing him. So it was insane to see that. But with Onama, this guy can get it done. Switching his stances, he has a great check hook, he has great power, mixes it up in all three ranges, head, body, and the legs. I mean, again, I'm selling you a very hot prospect with David Onama out of Uganda, training out of Glory MMA and Fitness. They've been so lately with their results, but I really do like the complete game of David Onama.
He had one of those classic Armin Zarukian UFC debuts where it's like, you lost, but no one cares because your stock still rose. And that was the fun thing about David Onama. Like, I agree with everything you just said and more. He looked amazing against Mason Jones, who's like a borderline lightweight welterweight, if anything. Like, he's as big as a lightweight can possibly get. And Onama did really well with the physicality of Mason Jones in that fight. And yes, that's partly why Mason Jones was able to win. But if you thought to yourself, okay, if they fought at 145 and Mason Jones was a little bit lighter, then that fight probably would be a little bit more competitive.
I don't think he's ever making 145.
No, I understand. I'm just saying, if Onama and Jones were closer in natural size, that fight probably would have been a lot more competitive. And it still was competitive for a guy making such short notice against the hyped up prospect. This is the UFC doing David Onama a huge favor, though. And listen, I'm the Mowgli Benitez guy on the internet. Probably because I'm the only person who's ever said those words, so it's just by default that crown falls on my head. But for Gabriel Benitez, he has a very bare-bones game, but he is good at what he's good at, and he knows what he's not good at. So what Gabriel Benitez, what his Hall of Fame skills are, is when you are at a really long distance with him, he will pick you apart. He's got great long distance weapons, a good 1-2. He's got great kicks to the leg, great kicks to the body. But he's a classic example of a fighter who at long range is very, very dangerous. But at close range, leaves a little bit to be desired. And I keep on going back to the Sadiq-Yusuf fight, and I think you can draw some parallels between that matchup and this one against David Onama, because when Gabriel Benitez had a lot of success against Sadiq-Yusuf, he was peppering the jab, landing the two as Yusuf was closing the distance on him. I think David Onama is going to try to land a lot of those similar power shots, but the difference is Onama can mix in his kicks a lot better.
Shoo. To go back to that, the one time where we saw Gabriel Benitez have a ton of success and win a fight on such short notice or on such short close range, that Justin Jaynes knee. Oh my gosh.
But a lot of his work, he was getting done at the long range, and that's what forced Justin Jaynes to close the distance on him.
100%. And I mean, for Javier Mendez, he's always talking about Gabriel Benitez, hardest kicker he's ever seen. I mean, listen, there's been some pretty good kickers at American Kickboxing Academy in San Jose, but Benitez, one of those guys, and he's an interesting case because 2-3 in his last five. You look at the win over Humberto Bandanai, which was insane. Like, that's one of the craziest finishes you're ever going to see, where he slams him and finishes him. But awesome. A loss to Sadiq Yusuf, a loss to Omar Morales, the win over Justin Jaynes, and the loss to Billy Quarantillo. The guys that he's lost to, good. I like Omar Morales. He's a fun fighter. That fight was at 155. The big thing for Benitez that he's never truly, like, on a stat sheet, missed weight and then fought, but he missed weight when he's supposed to fight Jonathan Pierce. And I have to wonder, like, backstage at the Apex this week, like, does Jonathan Pierce just give him the stink eye? Like, they're both on the same card. But Benitez, for that fight, weighed 150.5. He didn't look good on the scale. He ends up, his last time out, the Billy Quarantillo fight. That one was, what, 6 months ago? Almost 7 months ago. So it's been a while since we've seen Benitez in the fight. So if we look at the odds for this one, Benitez open a minus 125 favorite. He's a plus 134 underdog. Onama open a plus 105. He's a minus 162. So those odds have shifted. And when we look at this one, I mean, from a Tapology perspective, I'll just cut to the chase right now. 442 votes, 81% Onama, 78% by knockout. For the 19% that have Benitez, 64% by decision, Matt. I think, and we know this, you talked about it, Gabriel Benitez has a particular set of skills.
He does.
Long-range weapons. Some of the best kicks from southpaw you're going to find in MMA. We know this. And good boxing combinations. One good boxing combination.
I would say so.
One good combination.
Which means he doesn't have good boxing combinations.
When it comes up against a guy like David Onama, Gabriel Benitez really struggles against guys that can take him down. His takedown defense is incredibly porous. And against such a well-rounded guy in Onama, I see him having a really hard time.
I was just about to say, we seem to both be trending towards the David Onama pick. So I guess I'll just try to set up sort of how a Gabriel Benitez win might look early on. If he is able to land a lot of those calf kicks early on, like you said, he has some of the better pound-for-pound power in his kicks, regardless of whether it's to the leg, body, or head. And if he can really get those working early on and limit the movement of David Onama, it will make him more of a sitting target for Benitez to land his own power shots. But, like you said, Onama is well-rounded. Here's the thing I will say, though. I do expect him to still strike against Gabriel Benitez until things go poorly. I don't expect Onama to shoot a takedown until a big leg kick does land, until maybe Benitez is able to stun him with a big shot. I do like Onama quite a bit in this matchup, but the last thing I'm going to say about him and just sort of his ceiling overall, I'm a little worried he could become like the next Mark Chiesa. I don't think it's going to happen. It's just whenever there's someone who has like this kind of stellar, like action hero type of skill sets, that always worries me because of the fighter that Chiesa was. He was never able to improve. I don't see that being the case in Onama, but that's just always something that worries me.
I'm thinking Onama top 15 at featherweight, and it's going to come sooner than later, especially fighting guys that have been around for a long time like Gabriel Benitez. Yeah.
But Gabriel Benitez, if he loses this, will have been 1-4 in his last five. So I don't know if this will really change the career of Onama.
It's the win that you need and apparently the win that you want. Both of us going with Uganda's own David Onama to get the win. A guy who was able to really put on a fun fight his last time out. Didn't pick up fight of the night honors. They gave that to Gregory Rodriguez, a second round knockout over Jun Young Park. Come on.
I was just going to say, like, Mason Jones versus David Onama was on some people's fight of the year list. Now, yes, it was further to the bottom of it than it was to the top. But still, a lot of people said that that was one of the best fights of the year. And they didn't even award that with being the best fight on that night. It was ridiculous.
Wild stuff. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Do you have the man from Tijuana in Mexico? Or, again, Uganda's own. You let us know. Keep it locked in with Fightin' Apex, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
And the Ferris wheel of head kick knockouts comes full circle this weekend. We have Joaquin Numancia Buckley taking on Abdulrazak Alhassan. And why is there a Ferris wheel of leg kick knockouts? Because Joaquin Buckley did the dirty to Impa Kasanganai. And then Joaquin Buckley goes out and fights Alessio Di Chirico, who then returns that favor. And then Alessio Di Chirico goes out and fights Abdulrazak Alhassan, and then he returns the favor. So now, if this fight doesn't end by head kick
knockout... Is there like a Homeland-style like conspiracy board with all these head kicks connecting them?
The only connection that I get, because I didn't watch Homeland, is when we're looking for Pepe Silva over on...
There you go.
Yeah, over on Always Sunny in Philadelphia. But... Carol! When it comes to this fight, I don't know what Carol thinks, but I do know what I think, because for Abdulrazak Alhassan, it was a weird run, right? Like, he had those wins over Sabaho Masi, who's all the hotness, submitting the wrestler Jaleel Willis over with Bellator. So Sabaho Masi is on a really good run over there. Big wins that Abdul was able to get against him, and then he has the really long layoff. And it was really a mixed bag of, well, what are we going to get back from him? Because at 170, he looked depleted after the great first round he had against Munir Laziz. So then he moves up to 185, or sorry, he has one more fight against at 170 against Chaos Williams. He gets finished emphatically and quickly. So then he moves up to 185, takes on Jacob Malkoon, gets out-wrestled, even though he has a good judo background, which, hey, apparently Jacob can just go to the well with those takedowns and really make it gritty. And the weirdest part about it is, yes, he gets a head kick knockout against Di Chirico, does Alhassan his last time out, but it's been weird to see. He was a Fortis guy forever, then he makes the move to Elevation, he gets a couple of fights there under his belt. You have to think that the cardio improves in certain fights, but I don't know if we're going to need the cardio to be any more improved against a guy like Joaquin Buckley, where we're going in there and we're slinging from the moment it starts.
I don't think either one of these guys can have good cardio just based off of their fighting style and how hard they throw shots. And it's not like it's their like training camp or their training regime or anything, but like Abdulrazak Alhassan fights like that song Freight Train by Alan Jackson. Wish it was a diesel locomotive. Like, he just keeps on coming and there's no stopping once he does have his forward pressure. Now, he does start to slow down once that cardio is depleted, but I agree with you 100%. This fight is the fight that you're going to look at and think, well, that's going to end in the first round. I don't really see another result. Numancia is really interesting to me because a lot of people look at his like crazy head kick knockout of Impa Kisaganai and think to themselves, wow, he probably fights like a kickboxer, but he doesn't. Like, he really is a boxer when he is fighting MMA. It's a lot of that peekaboo style. He does a lot of ducking down and trying to respond with a lot of overhands. If you go back and watch the Kevin Holland fight, and I understand having to fight Kevin Holland as your UFC debut is a very hard ask, but Kevin Holland at that time wasn't really the Kevin Holland who went on that big run afterwards. Like, that started the big Kevin Holland run, but at the time he wasn't nearly as hyped up as he is now, and he made that fight look trivial. He went in there and he just proved that straight shots land a lot faster than looping shots do, and he made Buckley pay every single time he ducked down. And as I'm saying that, I'm like, hey, he's not the only guy who's made Joaquin Buckley pay for ducking down. Alessio Di Chirico, who is not a knockout artist by any stretch of the imagination, was able to time one of those ducks and land a head kick off of that. Now, I know that was sort of a weird strike. It was a weird angle. Like, would that head kick land every time they were very close? No. But what it does show is a flaw in Joaquin Buckley's just overall game. And I'm very curious to see if Abdulrazak Alhassan will be able to find that flaw early enough to capitalize on it. Because I do think Alhassan is a high-level enough striker and a cerebral enough striker to be able to look at whatever holes Buckley presents to him and try to capitalize on them. I just worry about when he is going to make that adjustment, because... like, if he figures it out in the third round, it's probably a little bit too late for him to actually land that one big shot. But let's say Alhassan can get the read on Buckley in the first 90 seconds of this fight. I fully expect him to land a clean head kick and win.
Oh, it's Kenny the Jet Smith. It's over. And when you look at it for Buckley, again, I'm eager to see what kind of changes we're going to see in his game. Because he's a guy that has been around to a lot of different gyms.
Isn't it weird how he kind of brags about how many gyms he's been kicked out of?
I don't know. I mean, Murciélago MMA, he's trained out of there in the past. It seems like he's at Extreme Couture right now, or he has been in the past couple of weeks on Instagram. Guys in the picture, Max Roshkoff, a guy who had such a bad UFC fight that he just decides to kind of, we're going somewhere else. He's looked really good lately, and he's cornered a lot of fighters, too, and he's in that camp. Sadibou Si, who, you want a good kickboxing look over there, that's good. And Chris Curtis was in the pick as well. So I'm interested to see what we get out of Buckley in this fight. But I want to talk about the odds before we move on much further. If you look at it for Joaquin Buckley, he is the favorite in this matchup.
Again, I'm surprised by that.
You got that three-fight losing streak there for Abdulrazak Alhassan that's not that far removed from. Razak opened a plus 130s, plus 124 or thereabouts right now. Joaquin Buckley opened a minus 150. He's still around there. We have a look at the Tapology votes and we'll cut the difference. 544 total votes, 66% Buckley, 82% by knockout for the 34% that have Al Haasem, 90% by knockout. So the fans, they anticipate a knockout. I anticipate, hope for a knockout. I really do. Hopefully we get it. Matt, this really is a tough one, though, because both guys are one-hitter quitters and anything can happen.
100%. Like, this is the most heavyweight, non-heavyweight fight we've ever gotten in the UFC, because you're either going to get two very fatigued guys in the second and third round. And I shouldn't really say that about Buckley, because he doesn't really fatigue that much as fights go on. He just doesn't have a crazy amount of volume. He sort of falls into that category. Like, it's hard to really get tired when you're not throwing a crazy amount of punches yourself, because he can rely on his own power. And he does have legitimate power. We've seen that throughout his UFC career, not just in that Impact Sanganai wild knockout. But again, most of his power does come from the boxing range and from his hands. So for me, I think Al Haasem has a great opportunity to win this fight, but again, it comes down to distance management. If he can catch Buckley on the way in with either a big shot, like a left straight or a head kick, then yes, he could win by knockout. But we saw what happened to Al Haasem when he fought Chaos Williams. Chaos Williams closed the distance in half a second, hit him one time and flatlined him. Joaquin Buckley does have a very similar skill set to Chaos Williams. It's not as refined by any means. I will give Chaos Williams that respect. But Buckley could knock out Al Haasem too. Not a great breakdown. Both guys could win by knockout. But I do slightly favor Abdul Razak Al Haasem in this matchup.
Matt going with Abdul Razak Al Haasem, the underdog in this one. And he's a guy that, he's interesting the way that he holds his hands because he keeps them low.
Too low for my liking, Craig.
Likes to throw the leg kick as well, which could work against a guy like Buckley, who can come out in either stance, which is interesting when he's doing that kind of peekaboo with his...
The old Alexander Hernandez.
Really wild hooks that he's able to throw. I like Joaquin Buckley in this fight. I think, again, both guys are fast twitch athletes. Oh, and at this point, I just have to favor the younger fighter in a fight like this. I think at Extreme Couture, whether we're working in a little bit of the wrestling, at least maybe feigning for some of those takedowns, maybe you go Moicano feint and then we throw the uppercut and just freak him out. But I am really eager to see this fight. We split on the pick. Matt going with Ghana's own Abdulrazak Al Haasem. I've got the man from St. Louis in New Mansa, Joaquin Buckley. Let us know down below. I'm sure this one's going to be a controversial pick as the week goes on. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend at lightweight. We will finally figure out if Jim Miller is a day late and a dollar short. He's taking on a heck of a striker in Brazil's Iron Nicolas Mata. Do not take Mike Tyson's nickname. The book, there's a Mike Tyson book here somewhere in the office behind us.
You don't get about it every time we mention it.
But when it comes to this fight, I mean, for Jim Miller, his last time out against Eric Gonzalez, he turned back the clock. The trouble was the day late, dollar short. In the first round, he did get outstruck by Ghost Pepper. He was kind of looking a little bit slow, and then the second round starts. Gonzalez got his hands down. Jim Miller, at close proximity, cold cocks him and knocks him dead. So for Jim Miller, he only has 5 of his wins by knockout or TKO. And that's one of them. Like, that's crazy to see because for Miller, we know him as this gritty, tough veteran. I mean, in the Clay Guida fight, they're going at it. They're rocking each other. That one was a lot of fun. That wasn't yesterday. Like, that fight was a little bit ago at this point. And for Miller, he's really accentuated that great pressure that he's able to mount on guys who just aren't at that skill level in terms of their grappling on the mat. He submits you. He makes it look easy. But there's certain fights, like when he fought Vince Paichel, where he can get held down and he can get caught just holding guard and waiting. And in a fight like this, we're not going to get that. Nicolas Mata is not that fighter. And before, when he was matched up with Jim Miller, which was back, early part of winter, I figured, okay, Mata's training at Factory X for this one. And Mata, I mean, this is just a cursed fight. He's had a lot of opponents fall out. This is kind of the second booking of this Jim Miller fight. He's gone back to Brazil, training at Nova União. So he's got Dede Pederneiras in his corner. But oh, by the way, Mata's there for the camp of RDA. That's why he is there. So really neat to see that. But Nicolas Mata is one of those guys. When we talk about a guy making his UFC debut, I know he did just win his last fight by decision on Contender Series. This guy has such fast hands. It's insane. So I really am excited to see Nicolas Mata make that debut. But Matt, picture yourself. You're in the back, you're getting ready for a fight, and you're there with Jim Miller.
Okay.
Do you anticipate he's just there with Dan Miller listening to Ram Jam on repeat?
Without a doubt.
Okay, so I can't wait to see it. I mean, IFL days at their core. But Jim Miller, absolute living legend, most fights in the UFC, looking to add to that coming up this weekend. Is he going to be able to add to the win total? I don't know, but I do like this booking here.
I'm going to quote Ricky Bobby to start this video. If you don't chew Big Red, then f*** you. And if you don't like Jim Miller, I feel that exact same way about you. Because Jim Miller, again, represents all the cool parts about MMA. He's an older fighter who's learned new things as he's progressed throughout his career. He used to be a main event level fighter. He had that famous main event against Cowboy Cerrone, where both of them were in the top 10. An Atlantic City main event. People forget how bopping Atlantic City was for like MMA and boxing for a long time. Unfortunately, not the heyday of Atlantic City anymore, but still, that was a really big event at the time, and Jim Miller has still been around since then. Like, I remember on the Fight Companion last night saying, oh, well, Derek Brunson, he's been a main event caliber fighter for 6 years now. Jim Miller's like, that's cool, hold my beer. I've been in the UFC for over 15 years. That's wild to me. Like, he's been around for longer than most champions have been in the organization. Since most champions have even fought their MMA careers, Jim Miller's been able to stay at the peak of competition for all this time. And it has been interesting because I know I say he's learned some new tricks. Maybe that's an over-exaggeration. He has improved as he's gotten older, though. I know we have seen some limitations in his game. Like you said, at this stage, he can get out-wrestled because physically, he isn't as explosive as he once was. Go back and watch the guy who fought Joe Lozon in those wars. Again, that was an explosive fighter, but he has taken a lot of damage at this stage of his career, and that's what I always worry about. Like, when you're a baseball player and you're 35, it's, hey, you can still be good, but you always worry about that one next injury. It could be your last one. In an MMA fight, every single time you go out there, you are taking a lot of damage. And with Jim Miller being 38 years old now, being in the UFC and only fighting the top levels of competition for such a long time, it does make me a little concerned when he's fighting such a top-level striker in a guy like Nicolas Mota, because in Mota, he is so much faster than Jim Miller on the feet that I do worry about how is Miller going to get his respect in the striking. Because I know Miller looked great against Gonzalez in his last fight, but I think we could both agree that that was sort of a flash in the pan. I think I don't really expect Jim Miller to go out in this fight throwing a lot of overhand lefts. If he does, I think it's going to be a very short night for him. But I think this is a great opportunity for Iron Mata coming out of Brazil. It's very rare that you get a level of competition or an opponent with the name of Jim Miller being your UFC debut.
And if you look at it, former common opponent between these guys in Joe Selecki, and for Jim Miller, true, he wasn't on the winning end of that fight. For Mata, he was. He finished him. So crazy to see that Mata, a guy that came on the Ultimate Fighter Brazil Season 4, lost to Glico França, a guy who was able to do some things and then do some dirty things over at the PFL and get a couple no contests on his record. Yeah. But when it comes to this fight, I mean, yeah, Mata is so much faster on the feet. Every fight starts out on the feet, and I think he's going to have decent enough takedown defense against Jim Miller. Miller is one of those guys. He's like, I don't know, like one of those weird stringy things that you put up in the summer for flies. He can really stick right to you.
I was gonna say he's like an old work coat. Like, it might not look good. It doesn't, like, you wouldn't wear it to town, but if you're ever doing something around the house, you just throw it on because you're afraid you're gonna ruin your other clothes. Wow. Like, it gets the job done, but it's not really something that you flaunt around telling people, hey, watch MMA because Jim Miller's fighting this week.
I think you're seeing a lot of those coats at Canadian Tire. But when it comes to this fight, Matt, we look at the odds. Jim Miller open a -185 favorite, plus 149 right now for Mata, the comeback. Open to plus 160. He is a minus 179 favorite. If we look at the overall card, he is the biggest mover and shaker at a 65% clip. We have a look at Tapology for the votes. Okay, I'll make this one fun. We haven't seen them. You haven't seen them, Matt. I'm going to set the over-under at 80%. For your UFC debuting fighter.
I don't know if I've got one of these right all day, by the way. I'll say it's over.
All right, so we have a look. It's under. 520 total votes, 69% Miller. What? 58% by submission for the 31% that have Mata, 62% by decision. I think Nicolas Mata goes out there and boxes his head in. I mean, again, I love Jim Miller, and I've come across, like, you know, without any reverence for his overall career. I've let you carry that torch in this video. Jim Miller is that crafty veteran that is the litmus test of, are you meant for the UFC or not? Remember the Roosevelt-Robert fight? Roberts fight?
I'm trying to think what my favorite Jim Miller fight is.
I mean, that was one of those ones where Roberts coming in with a head of steam, and then he makes a terrible mistake, and Jim Miller's able to capitalize and get the win. But for Mata, his striking is so good. It's so crisp. In a fight like this, I saw Eric Gonzalez have success in the first round against Jim Miller. I think Mata is quite a bit better than Gonzalez. I think he's a lot better than Miller on the feet. I think Mata's going to get the win. I wouldn't be surprised if he gets a TKO in this one either.
No, I wouldn't either. Now, if Jim Miller gets a takedown 1 minute into this fight, it's over for Mata, and he's probably getting choked unconscious. I still think Jim Miller has that ability to just sort of go and get it, if you will, and really force his opponent down to the mat. I think he's going to really struggle with his takedown attempts in this fight, and I do like Mata quite a bit.
Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Can Jim Miller go out there, turn back the clock once more and get the submission victory. I was reading a breakdown from back in early winter, and somebody had him to win that way. I think it was like plus 350 or plus 375. Wow. Maybe you like it that way. Both of us going with Brazil's Nicolas Motta to get the win in his UFC debut against a guy who has been around since 2008 with the promotion. 14 years. Wild stuff. That's there. Insane. Listen, you're going to want to see the rest of the week that is, because we have an American and a Brazilian in our main event, Jamahal Hill taking on Johnny Walker. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Big time heavyweight fight coming up this weekend. We have Parker Porter taking on France's own, the Black Samurai, Alain Badeau. And listen, this is a fight that's going to happen this week. And if you put your hard-earned money on it, then that's on you, because it's silly. And this is a ridiculous fight. And for Alain Badeau, the last time he won a fight legitimately was back in May of 2018. You'll go, Craig, but he won in 2019. I'm going to say, hey, no, he didn't. He lost to Todd Stout. But Stout ends up getting disqualified after the fact, like way after the fact. And instead of calling it a no contest, they call it a win for Alain Badeau. But if you go back and watch it, he gets submitted in that fight. So, again, I'm not splitting hairs. He lost that fight soundly to Todd Stout. So, off of that, the UFC signs him to fight Tom Aspinall, and the biggest head scratcher I've ever seen. He gets knocked out in the first round. Then he goes out there and takes on Rodrigo Nascimento, and you go, Craig, there was a lot of comments out there. Alain Badeau is going to knock this guy out. Nope. Standing TKO win for Rodrigo Nascimento. Got into some of the dark stuff outside of the octagon. It's overturned to a no contest. So realistically, Alain Badeau's last legitimate win inside a cage was in May of 2018, a TKO win in the first round against Yuto Nakajima, who was 0-2 at the time. Before that, a loss to Dalcha Lunjambula. And if you want to see a guy cold cock a guy up near the fence, it's Dalcha Lunjambula beating Alain Badeau. That fight back in 2017, that fight at light heavyweight. So for Alain Badeau, big frame for this division, but a guy who does not use his length and his size at all to his advantage in his fights.
Alain Badeau is kind of like, they bring up his personality before a lot of his skills. Well,
trains
on draft
with Cyril Gaon, you know.
Exactly, and that would be exactly what Joe Rogan says as he's walking out, and then everyone else should get concerned. Now, I have been very difficult on Parker Porter throughout his UFC tenure, but what I will say is he seems to be improving at 36 years of age, and that's not something we can often say for a heavyweight who is unranked. It is one thing for like a Tai Tuivasa, for instance, start getting better as their career progresses, but for Parker Porter, I didn't have very high hopes for him coming into the UFC, but his last two performances has definitely shown me more ability than I ever thought we would see out of him.
Now, when we look at this fight, again, I expect this to be completely standing. I mean, for Parker Porter, he would be the more susceptible, I dare say, to kind of mix in a takedown against Alain Badeau. And that's something that could definitely work to his advantage. You look at it for both of these guys, the striking output is insane. 7.81 strikes landed per minute, significant strikes for Alain Badeau, to 8.06 received. 39% striking defense against Rodrigo Nascimento, who beat him by knockout. He's a jiu-jitsu specialist. And Tom Aspinall, who's a future title challenger. And if you look at it for Parker Porter, his takedown defense in the UFC hasn't been all that great, but he took down Josh Parisian. He was able to take down Chase Sherman. Again, level of competition for both these guys. Not the strongest suit on their record. However, one of these guys has fought John Jones in their career, and it's Parker Porter. So, interesting to see, but for Badeau, he doesn't tend to use his length all that well, and that's a thing that concerns me with a guy who is always going to be, or just about always going to be, at a height and reach advantage in his fights.
Well, the thing about Porter is, Porter has very, very good cardio for the heavyweight division, and he does have a very high level of output, too. Again, for being someone who isn't really a technical striker, like, he's not a bad striker by any means, but I really see him overwhelming Alain Badeau with his volume on the feet, and it's interesting with Parker Porter. Again, not someone who has the craziest wrestling background, but he isn't afraid to mix it into a lot of his fights, and I do see that being a big benefit against someone like Badeau, because if you go back and watch some of his fights in TKO, he is susceptible to getting held to the ground. I know we've seen a lot of his TKO losses in the UFC, but his grappling defense really does leave a lot to be desired. He doesn't have bad takedown defense. He can dig under hooks. He is a very long guy for the division, but once you do get him down, you can hold him down. He's someone who tries to use a closed guard, but like you said, very big frame, so it still leaves a lot of space for his opponent to posture up and land a lot of good shots. And I think a guy like Parker Porter, not that he was built in a lab to beat somebody like Alain Badeau, because I don't think anyone would put that many resources into that mission, but I do think Parker Porter's overall pressure and the ability to use the takedown if he really does have to is going to be really good against a guy like Badeau, because Badeau doesn't do well with guys who can mix it up and who are sort of that dual threat heavyweight.
It's going to be a really tricky one. So like I said at the start of the video, I wouldn't put a whole heck of a lot of money on this. I mean, for Parker Porter, you look at the 5-on-in, win over Kevin Sears, who was 6-5. The win over Broenstrup was actually a fun one if you go back and watch it with CES. He loses to Chris Daukaus in his UFC debut, and that's where I kind of, ooh, I don't see this for Parker Porter. It was a weird signing, to be honest. The guy who's,
exactly, a little bit older in his career. He had been around for a while, too, and that's what I was surprised about. Like, he was sort of known to the UFC, and he was just never signed for a long time, so it would have been nice if we could see him earlier on. I know he doesn't have the best record in the world, but it has been nice to see his overall improvements throughout the UFC at this stage of his career.
And I mean, if you look at it for Alain Badeau, I guess his marquee win against any decent competition was back in 2015. He beat Shinsuke Inoue back at Heat 38 in, yeah, November 2015. So again, losing records and pro debuts after that. We have a look at the Tapology votes for this one. 511 total votes, 84% Porter, 47% by decision, 46% by TKO. Implied probability that Parker Porter wins 71.4%, as he's a minus 250 favorite for Badeau, the comeback, plus 200. I've got Parker Porter, but it's unranked heavyweights. Could Porter go out there and get hit by a big shot and Badeau knock him out? Sure, it could definitely happen. That's definitely Badeau's path to victory. Porter is a guy that crowds space, and if Badeau can keep him honest and earnest, that's definitely a way that he's going to be able to get the win. So if you like Alain Badeau, let us know down below in the comments section. But Matt, I mean, for me, I've got Parker Porter. I've been down on Alain Badeau coming into the UFC, so I definitely have that bias is there for sure. But he didn't even beat Todd Stout, and they have it a disqualification in a fight. I watched him get submitted and lose, and then he ends up in the UFC. He got knocked out by Dalcha Lunjambul in a striking affair, which is going to happen. It can happen. It hasn't really happened in the UFC that much, but it could happen. And then in the UFC, the losses, I mean, Nascimento knocks you out. Like, yikes, man.
What are we doing
here? What are we doing here? So I don't have the greatest view of Badeau.
So I guess let's leave it on this thing, because you both quite obviously have Parker Porter. Is there a world where he'd get into the top 15, do you think? Like, if he wins this, okay, then what kind of opponent do you think Porter could get matched up with next?
Sergey Pavlovich.
So it would be one of those, like, borderline top 15 guys, because if he beats Pavlovich, then we're off to the races.
Not happening. Both of us going with Parker Porter in this fight. Unranked heavyweights, though, so there's a lot of red flags. Make up your mind. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have, and keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Your co-main event coming up this weekend at middleweight, we have Kyle Daukaus taking on Jamie Pickett. And listen, for the Night Wolf, he's surging all of a sudden. I mean, coming into the UFC, it really was difficult to try and cap a ceiling for Jamie Pickett, because he had been on Contender Series a few different times. He has that 30-punch combination against Jonathan Pate that gets him in, and then he loses to Tufan Chukwe, where he's not able to implement his volume. Tufan's able to push a pace, able to land his power shots. He goes out there and takes on Jordan Wright, gets knocked out in a fire fest. And then when he goes to take on Laureano Staropoli, only 3 months ago, it's like, okay, well, both these guys need a win, and they're getting kicked out. And for Laureano Staropoli, it was back to Argentina. He lost that fight. Jamie Pickett was able to finally use that upper body strength in the clinch, able to land his volume. And then he goes out there his last time against Joseph Holmes, and he loses the first round emphatically. He really does. That fight was January 15th, so just about a month apart, he takes a short-notice fight against Kyle Daukaus. And when I look at it, I mean, it is interesting, because for Kyle Daukaus, he's one of those guys that really believes in a stand-up, but I think against a guy like Jamie Pickett, that could almost be to a fault, because Kyle Daukaus, definitely the more powerful guy.
Oh, yeah.
But when you've got a guy like Jamie Pickett that just peppers, and he's able to defend the takedowns, it's a blueprint to beat a guy like Kyle Daukaus. However, fan support is 100% there for Kyle Daukaus, and this guy still has a very high ceiling in this division. When you look at it, his last true blue fight obviously has a no contest against Kevin Holland, where you knock him out and submit him, but under dubious circumstances. Obviously, you had the clash of heads. Before that, a loss to Phil Haas, a win over Dustin Stoicefus, and a loss to Brandon Allen in his UFC debut. We look at that loss to Brandon Allen with a lot of reverence, because Kyle Daukaus was able to really rally back as that fight went on.
Yeah, that's one of those losses, again, where you have a UFC debut against a very talented fighter. You come up short, but you gain a lot of fans and stock in the process. I think this fight is a phenomenal example, though, as to why MMA records are for DJs. They don't mean anything. And 5-on-ins don't even really mean that much. Because for Jamie Pickett, let's be honest, his last two wins aren't over the highest level of competition. We were very open about the fact that Joseph Holmes left a lot to be desired coming into the UFC. And for Staropoli, he was a welterweight who then moved up to this weight class, and he really did get outmuscled by Jamie Pickett, and that's why I do find this fight very difficult to break down, because I personally don't believe Jamie Pickett has evolved that much throughout his MMA career. You could argue against it, I don't really have that much to say, but he's only fought greatly reduced levels of competition in his last two matchups, and I do think that's why the odds are what they are for this fight, because for Daukaus, yes, he has some losses, but they are to some very, very talented fighters, and in his last one against Kevin Holland, yes, there was that headbutt, but he was still looking good early on in that fight. He was holding his own in some of the striking exchanges, and against a guy like Kevin Holland, if you can at least hold your own in the striking, and then the fight goes to the mat, I would expect Daukaus to have some success, but I just think this fight's very odd when you look at their recent sort of levels of success and where the odds are, because like you said, Daukaus, the fan support's going to be with him. The odds are with him, but he hasn't had the most successful run throughout the UFC, so this really is his opportunity to get back on track and prove that he is the hyped up prospect, and that he's not just Chris's brother, because Chris Daukaus was really able to get into the UFC, get off running, had a main event slot against Derek Lewis. Like, he's had some really big opportunities in this sport, and you know Kyle wants to be in that same position. He's going to need to beat Jamie Pickett and probably do it impressively if he wants to get up into that altitude.
And for Kyle Daukaus, a big portion of the conversation is the fights that have fallen out. Like, he had an interview on this channel. He was getting ready for Ali Askab Hezriev, and we did a big time breakdown on it. I thought Hezriev was going to win. He's a wild fighter, fan-friendly style. That fight falls out. He fights Kevin Holland, no contest. They rebook it, and then Holland's out due to injury. And then you look at it, he's supposed to take on Roman Dolidze. COVID protocols, that fight doesn't happen. Then this weekend, he's supposed to take on Julian Marquez. Now Marquez is out, and instead it's Jamie Pickett. So for Kyle Daukaus, you get a fight, I guess. And that is something exciting, I guess, to look forward to. But in taking on a guy like Jamie Pickett, again, we talked about him where he was an interesting fighter coming into the UFC, but it was really hard to try and cap where his ceiling was because, I mean, not really the greatest to run. Like, you look at Jamie Pickett's overall record, you talk about it being for DJs, but 13-6 the overall record, loses to Punahele Soriano on Contender Series, loses to Charles Byrd on Contender Series. Like, it really is hard when those are the guys that you're losing to. You beat Jaquise Williams, who was 7-10. You beat Jonathan Pate, 6-3. Pate, I mean, even Joseph Holmes beat Pate emphatically to get his shot in the UFC. And James Krause had to really advocate for that opportunity to get him signed on Dana White's Looking for a Fight, Looking Forward to a Fight. The show is the show.
Did Dana White jump off a cliff? Who knows?
No, that was just the Hawaii one. And Rachel Ostovich did. Noted UFC fighter Rachel Ostovich. But in this matchup, Matt, again, Pickett, I'm sure there's going to be pockets for Pickett to have success on the feet. But I do think Kyle Daukaus is going to take this one. I mean, I look at the odds. Daukaus open to minus 250. Minus 220 right now. Again, short notice nature of this fight, like a lot of them on this card. Jamie Pickett open to plus 210. He's plus 180. If we have a look at the fan vote on Tapology, I expect it to be heavily skewed Daukaus' way. So I'll say over under 87.5% Daukaus.
I'll say over.
You're going to say over? Ooh. 400 total votes, 87% with Daukaus, 44% by decision, 46% by submission for the 13% that I pick it, 56% by decision, 26-ish percent by knockout. So, Matt, laid it out for both guys. I think Pickett has a fun opportunity this weekend on short notice. You know, still fight ready after that camp, but not training at fight ready. But yeah, for me, I mean, I like the little improvements I've seen out of Daukaus with Martinez, BJJ, but I think when it comes to the mat, you know, it's going to be a fish out of water type situation for Pickett.
This is one of those classic fights where Pickett has the very slim chance to win by knockout early on in the fight. But on short notice, it's going to be really hard to ask a guy to be out grappling Kyle Daukaus and to expect a guy to have cardio to grapple with a guy like Kyle Daukaus in the 10th minute of a fight, the 11th. 12th, 13th, 14th, like, that last round is going to be really hard for Jamie Pickett if he does make it to that point. Again, he has good power. He could get a knockout early because Kyle Daukaus doesn't have the best striking defense, but I fully expect Daukaus to get this fight to the mat and probably win it down there.
Let us know who you have coming up this weekend. Jamie Pickett, the Night Wolf, or will it be Chris's brother, Kyle? It's set to be an interesting fight, a middleweight that will happen in a division that needs contenders. So I can't wait for this one. And your main event, at 205 pounds. Johnny Walker taking on Jamahal Hill. Ooh, boy, what a big fight. You're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Big time main event. And yes, you heard that right. Main event. This one, a five rounder on 8 days' notice between Johnny Walker and Sweet Dreams Jamahal Hill. And for Jamahal Hill, what an interesting run it has been in the UFC. I mean, known as such a great striker, his lone loss was where he kind of bragged up his ground game against Paul Craig and just got caught in an awful, awful submission. But a great rebound his last time up and a giant TKO finish over Jimmy Crute, where he was able to land the same shot twice at two different opportunities and gets that finish, one more for a stamp of approval, and it was all she wrote. So for Hill, riding a huge wave of momentum, taking on Johnny Walker, whose last fight was a five-rounder. He was back at SBG Ireland, where he is for this fight. And oddly enough, in that fight against Thiago Santos, from Johnny Walker, we normally see a fun, flashy style, a lot of power, a lot of creativity, and that's what you know and love out of him. But he was kind of a little shy in that fight. He was a little bit more reserved than we normally see. And the oddest part about that fight was the fact that John Kavanaugh, in terms of reservedness, kind of telling Johnny Walker that he was really close in that fight and that maybe he had the opportunity to win it on points as it was going on, which, you know, who am I to critique John Kavanaugh? He knows a hell of a lot more than I do about MMA, but it was weird to see that, especially going back on the rewatch of that fight against Santos. So for Walker, you go from former title challenger to the hottest prospect in this division right now. It is a good matchup on paper. I'm just surprised that they didn't Bellator this one and go for a three-round main event.
And we've seen the UFC do that before. They did Anthony Smith versus Alexander Rakic for a three-round main event. They did Derek Brunson versus Edmund Shabazian as a three-round main event. Like, there has been a precedent for giving the co-main event sort of three-round responsibility if it is bumped up to the main event. But I am excited that we are going to get an extra 10 minutes out of this fight. And I will say this too. I don't think we're going to need those extra 10 minutes, Craig, because the way that Johnny Walker fights at his apex is a knockout artist who's very unorthodox. It's that security through obscurity. I don't have to worry about getting hit because everything I do is so unorthodox that it keeps my opponent just sort of on edge and second-guessing themselves constantly. I think this fight is a very, very tricky one, sorry, for Johnny Walker, because if he is able to beat Jamahal Hill, then he is a way better fighter than I ever thought he was, and I can openly admit that. Like, the guy who fought Thiago Santos the last time out, I didn't think he was a high-level fighter, because you have to remember where Thiago Santos was in that main event. Craig was onto this before, like a lot of people, where it's like, hey, his knees are jacked up. I would say we both were on his knees jacked up, but then there was the whole, the Capoeira stuff, where the footage was from like 6 years before. It was all very strange. I would say that Santos has been getting better since his initial surgery after the John Jones fight, but he still isn't 100%. And the Thiago Santos that fought Johnny Walker didn't move all that well. He could move forward and backwards, but he was still getting some of his left to right back. And I thought Santos won that fight for full transparency. It wasn't a great main event. Like, we've rewatched these fights, so you don't have to. I didn't think very highly of Johnny Walker leaving that fight because on the inside, he would eat a shot, not respond with anything, go back out to long range, and just kind of play around and never be dedicated to any of his own attacks. And I look at this fight in two very separate ways. Let's say we get a similar Johnny Walker who is hesitant to get in and out of the pocket. Then I think Jamahal Hill can just march him down, close off the cage, because that's what Jamahal Hill is phenomenal at, making the cage much smaller than it really is and making you pay for it. And the flip side is, let's say Johnny Walker has an overcorrection, if you will. He saw how hesitant he was his last time out and he goes, okay, let's be the wild man again. He's probably just going to open himself up to get knocked out that much earlier, because when you're Johnny Walker and you are that crazy wild striker, those things work against primary grapplers and guys who aren't super, super technical on the feet. Look at Justin Ledet. He got knocked out by a spinning back fist. Look at Misha Serkinov. A great fighter, but not a great striker. Jamahal Hill is as technical as it gets on the feet, and I really do think that the more wild techniques Johnny Walker throws is going to get him in trouble.
Well, now let's set it up in a different way, because for Jamahal Hill, you know him as a really good counter striker, good on the back foot, good when he's moving forward. We called him OSP 2.0, and then he goes out there and finishes OSP. And if you look at a guy like Jamahal Hill, obviously all the attributes are there. Now, he trains at Black Lion Jiu-Jitsu, and he really talked that up before that Paul Craig fight, and then he gets his elbow dislocated and overconfidence. But maybe for a young-ish fighter, because he's not as young as you think. He's 30 at this point, but he's still young in his MMA career. Obviously, his ground game, not his bread and butter. Against Johnny Walker, you assume he's going to be able to accentuate his own skills on the feet. But for Walker, And we talk about paths to victory. Obviously, he came into the UFC, win on Contender Series, and then he wins three big ones in a row, all performance bonuses. Loses to Corey Anderson, Beast in 25-8, which was a big surprise for a lot of people. Future Bellator light heavyweight champ. I'm saying it right now. He loses to Nikita Krylov, and he gets absolutely outclassed on the mat. And then he goes out and fights Ryan Spann, who, if you've ever seen somebody that's way too dedicated to leaving their head out there and on a double leg takedown, Ryan Spann's been knocked out multiple times by elbows when he goes for takedowns.
Spann hurt Johnny Walker in that fight.
Spann hurt Johnny Walker not once, but twice in that fight. Walker's able to get the finish win. It was a good one in the first round. But again, his last time against Santos, threw at a lower percentage than Santos, landed more strikes. But when you're landing 48 significant strikes in five rounds, I'm surprised they give you a main event. That's off the laurels of the three performance bonuses he was able to have coming into the UFC.
Also, this wasn't supposed to be the main event.
That's true. But my question to you is, if Johnny Walker is going to get a win against Jamahal Hill, what does it have to look like?
I think he's going to have to clinch up like he did against Khalil Roundtree Jr., if I'm being honest. Because, I know I've incorrectly predicted Jamahal Hill's last two fights, but I've still said what he's going to do sort of the right way. Like, Jamahal Hill doesn't have a complicated game to break down. He's probably the best pure striker other than Jiří Procházka right now in the division because he mixes in his kicks really well. He has legit power on the feet. Maybe, I'm sure there's people out there who are disagreeing with that. Oh, Jan Blachowicz, oh, whoever. I really do think Jamahal Hill is on that level as a pure striker. Maybe his defensive grappling leaves more to be desired than some of those other fighters, but I gotta be honest, I still don't think Jamahal Hill's a zero on the mat. Like, I know he got submitted by Paul Craig. Maybe there was overconfidence in that. But I don't think it's a case of, well, if you're fighting Jamahal Hill, all you have to do is shoot a double leg and you're going to beat him. So I do think that there's a grappling side to his game that we haven't seen yet that I do think will be unlocked at some point. Maybe this is the fight we see that from Hill. But to answer your question, I think if you're Walker, use some of those long-range attacks because he is so rangy for this weight division. And try to use the leg kick. I know it's not something we see all that often out of Walker.
Did it a lot in his last fight, though.
But exactly. Did it a lot in his last fight against Thiago Santos. That does seem to be a tool that he's added to his game. And let's say he can chop down that lead leg of Jamahal Hill. It's really going to limit his forward pressure with his boxing. I do think that'll pay off. But I see this fight as the second Jamahal Hill closes the distance, I think it's over. Johnny Walker, to say he has a poor chin might be giving it too much credit, and Jamahal Hill really does put guys to sleep when he hits them one time.
It's funny when you look at the numbers, Fight Night Picks of old, we were two number heavy, then there was a point where we never looked at them. The funniest part about it though for Johnny Walker is last fight against Thiago Santos, low totals in terms of strikes. It was a fight that just not much did happen. 66% of Walker's strikes were to the leg, but he went 32 of 55. He's got to commit and go all in on those leg kicks against a guy like Jamahal Hill, who has really good movement defensively. And the thing that I like about Jamahal Hill is when guys start to kick at him, he does a great job of moving his arms to block the kicks, whether it's to the head, whether it's to the body. Very, very defensively aware with his striking defense. And for Johnny Walker, 40% striking defense in the UFC, definitely not up to snuff. I mean, 45% for Jamahal Hill. But again, they do these things in different ways. Much better volume out of Hill, albeit lower level of competition in a certain respect. And the takedown defense for either of these guys, definitely not their bread and butter. So when we look at the odds, Walker open a plus 198 average on best fight odds, plus 215 right now. We look at it for Jamahal Hill, open minus 240, minus 270 right now. Tapology could be our friend, Matt. I'll also talk about the YouTube community tab because we do have votes over there. But over on Tapology, 78% of the fans have Jamahal Hill to get the win. He is favored to get the win. I mean, do you think the Johnny Walker fans, do they show up strong for the guy this weekend?
Not at all. I think this is an awful fight stylistically for Johnny Walker, if I haven't made that abundantly clear.
Oh my goodness.
I really do. It's just, Johnny Walker leaves massive holes in his striking defense. Jamahal Hill, quite obviously, has crippling one-punch knockout power. I think it's just a story that writes itself, to be completely honest.
All right, hot take, Tony. So, 6 hours ago, we put it up to you in the YouTube community tab. 69%. Of the fans have Jamahal Hill getting the win. Mr. Face, we should just ask the judges or John Anik who's going to win since they already know. Mr. Face is obviously upset about last weekend's judging. What else? Jake saying, do we forget how good Walker was at one point? Paul Pierce, old PP. He's saying Hill by any way he wants. And we also have Ishin saying Hill by KO in the first.
So the Johnny Walker faithful have not shown up.
Yeah, the faithful. They're not showing up for this one. Interesting, again, to see Johnny Walker back at SBG for another training camp, because he's another one of those guys that's bounced from gym to gym to gym. And he's been at SBG in the past, and then he went to Russia, and then he went to TriStar, and then he was
been all over.
Then he was in Vegas, but now he's back to SBG, second camp in a row. I'm eager to see it, but for me, I've got Jamal Hill in this fight. I really do believe he is one of those like creme de la creme strikers. It's just when you take on a guy like a Jiří Procházka, Glover Teixeira, Jan Blachowicz, like one of those really top guys, and there aren't many right now in this division. Even I'd love to see him fight Dominic Reyes, Southpaw versus Southpaw. That'd be a fun matchup if Reyes could fully heal.
I was just about to say, I gotta be honest, Craig, I don't want to see that fight at all, because Dominic Reyes is coming off two pretty brutal losses. Like, I think that's
couple years down the road.
He needs a bunch of wins, I think, to be completely... Like, this is the question I'm going to ask you, because this is what I truly believe. You said Hot Take Tony, you need a better name. Here's the thing. I think Jamal Hill is going to fight for a title within 18 months. I really do. I think with the division being as shallow as it is, and with his fighting style being as exciting as it is, I think if he goes in there and has a great performance against Johnny Walker, it's going to mean that his next fight is either going to be a Fight Night main event that he will have a full 8-week training camp to get ready for, or it's going to be like a pay-per-view main card type of a spot. And I think if he does beat Johnny Walker, especially if he's able to finish him, then he's probably only one win away from a title shot. But I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
I mean, a big-time opportunity, obviously, when you look at it for Jamal Hill. And it's one of those divisions that's really shallow. I mean, we talked about it with middleweight. They have an opportunity to co-main event this weekend again. But it's one where Jared Cannonier, most likely your next title challenger at 185. But at 205, I mean, you've got Jan Blachowicz, your number one contender, Procházka getting the shot for the belt. You've got Rakic, who's looked a little lackluster lately. Anthony Smith still doing the damn thing, hanging on. Thiago Santos, Ankalaev, who's the hotness right now. But then after that, Reyes, Uzdemir, Krylov's fun, Walker, Craig, Hill,
I know
Span, Kutsalaba.
I know it's 12 fighting 10, but I could see Jamal Hill going up as high as number 7 if he is able to get the win. Just because when you look at the division, Dominic Reyes is coming off of 2 losses. Volkan Uzdemir is behind him. A lot of guys coming off losses right there. So I could see Hill jumping up in the rankings quite a bit. And then from that point on, like you said, Ankalaev and him could be like a title eliminator almost at this point.
I'm thinking the winner at this point gets Santos or Smith. I don't see a reason that you need to rematch those guys against themselves. So me, I'm taking the man himself, Jamal Hill. Both of us going with a tricky southpaw striker. In this one, we will have Fight Night Picks question mark kicks. That's 2 hours. It's live. It's before the prelims even start. You get an opportunity to have a look back at the week that was, get to factor in the weigh-ins. This coming out on Monday night. And if there's any updates, like Mario Bautista, who's supposed to fight Khalid Taha, but it seems like that fight has fallen out, when and if he gets an opponent, we will be quick to get that video out to you, because man, Mario Bautista, what a fun fighter he is. So looking forward to all of that. Keep it locked in here on the YouTube channel. Toss a like and a sub. It really does go a long way. And as we always say, Matt, with Fight Night Picks,
let's get into it.